All right.
Nick!
Gentlemen!
Nick's your buddy.
Kind of guy you can drink a beer with.
Start your engine!
My papa's son wandering out a smoking gun. Now some of you would live through me and lock me up and throw away the key, or just find a place to hide away and hope that I'll just go away. But I feel alright. I feel alright tonight.
All right. Good morning, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studio in downtown Chicago here till 5 a.m. I'm your overnight dude, 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. every weekday morning. It's Monday morning. So that means we got the movie reviews. Jim Laskowski is off this week, but Eric Childress will be here, and we'll review the new movies, and we'll talk about the box office. And Eric has some more movies to review that he saw at the South by Southwest Film Festival in Austin. So we got exclusive reviews for that. It is Monday. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke, because it's a jokey time. We got some other fun movie topics that we're going to jump into. Good movies that have absurd scenes in them. Iconic movie scenes that weren't planned. And then some casting decisions that made fans angry. That's all coming up here on the show. If you would like to join us, it's 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200 for talk and text. You can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show and stay connected with us on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Nick D Show on this Monday morning. 312-981-7200 for talk and text as well. Ben Anderson is producing the show this morning. Ben, how are you?
Doing pretty good.
Yeah. Did you have a good weekend? You all right?
Yep. There we go. It was on, but nothing was going on in my headphones.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so all I right. can hear you now.
Okay, you can hear me. Yeah, so how was your weekend?
It was pretty good. Finally got to see Captain Marvel. And, yeah.
You like it?
I loved it.
Yeah.
I thought it was pretty awesome.
Yeah, I liked it a lot too, and it's making a lot of money. We'll get to the box office a little bit later on.
Yeah, those numbers were huge.
Yeah, they're huge. It just makes me happy for Brie Larson because I love Brie Larson. I just think she's great, and I think she's great in the movie. Really, really great.
Yeah, I hate saying it, but like half the time I was watching, I was like, oh man, I get where Nick's coming from now.
Oh man, please,
I got it.
She's amazing, man. She's amazing, and I'm really glad that she's. That she's really, you know, like, can also now get butts in seats. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, it proves that Brie Larson, you know, can be a box office draw, as well as just a really terrific actress, too.
Yeah.
Because she's great. She really is great. So, yeah, making a lot of money. We'll tell you all about how much money it made a little bit later on when Eric Childress joins me. And so there you go. Now we're in the newsroom. It's Vic Vaughn. Hi, Vic.
Hey, Nick.
How are you, man?
I'm really good, actually. Had
are
a
you?
Really good weekend.
And what'd you do?
I think it was the sun, you know, the sunshine that made it so enjoyable. I didn't actually go to the parade this year, actually. We watched it from my apartment with binoculars.
Oh, yeah.
And then afterwards, I went and got a nice walk along the lake. And then Sunday did the same thing. Took the dog out for another long walk and just... Really, you know what else? We decided to, I guess you could call it a pilot program. We decided to try to wean me off of, and I know you use a fan as well at night, right? When you sleep.
I do, yes.
We were weaning me off of this 3 nights in a row now. No fan.
Really?
Yeah. And we made a compromise. We have, you know, the Echo Dots pretty much in every room of my apartment, and we're using it to play like meditation music and as the white noise instead of a fan. It's real low. It's real calming, and it's working. 3 nights in a row, no fan.
Wow.
I feel great.
Oh. Now, was there a reason why you didn't want to have the fan anymore? Or
I actually wasn't for me. I like it. I still like it, but yeah. Jeannie...
Well, that's the thing, you know, when you're not the only person, because I, you know, obviously I live alone and I sleep alone, so I can have the fan.
Right.
You know, but when I was married, or you know, the fan was a little bit more... more of a compromise that we had, you know, you'd have to make, because some people don't want a fan, you know, blowing on them while they sleep.
I'd still be using it if I was alone, but yeah, with her, I decided to try it, and yeah, three nights. So I think I'm going to keep with it.
Wow. All right. If you're not using your fan, you can give it to me. I can have two at the foot of my bed then. Because I can't. I love the fan on, and you know, not just for the white noise, but for the breeze as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even if it's like 30 below.
I know, man. Me too. I know it.
So anyway, yeah. So interesting. Nice weather for St. Patrick's Day for this weekend. It really turned out really nice. You know, there have been days, you know, obviously we've had snow, we've had sleet, all kinds of weather, because you never know what you're going to get in March. But I guess everything turned out okay for everybody for St. Patrick's Day over the weekend. Big turnout for the parade. Must have been, was it nuts down here, Vic? Because you live down here. Was it absolutely insane?
No, I didn't see. But then again, I wasn't out. I wasn't around the parade this year. I was, 43rd floor, so kind of a bird's eye view. But
yeah,
from there, it looked really calm.
Well, sure.
I don't know. I wasn't amongst them.
You were 43 stories above everybody, man.
It looked really well behaved.
Yeah.
But so I can't really speak to that. I went out afterwards. And normally, you would see some craziness going on. I didn't see any of that, but, you know, I don't know. Maybe someone who was there might have a different perspective.
I'm sure they might have. I saw some people were, you know, like, obviously posting a bunch of stuff on social media and everything. And so I did follow along on some of that. And a couple of my friends went to Chief O'Neill's, which is an Irish pub over on Elston that we used to frequent all the time when I was with the Factory Theater, because we performed out of the space across the street. So we were at Chief O'Neill's all the time. And I saw some footage of the Pipers performing there. And the place, of course, was packed, you know, because it's, you know, you go to a place like Chief O'Neill's, it's going to be completely packed.
Sure.
For St. Patrick's Day. But, yeah, I usually stay away from those celebrations. You know, I was basically
understandable.
Yeah. My folks and I did go to a movie on Saturday afternoon, which Eric and I will review in just a few minutes. I don't even quite know what to say about the movie. I still don't know. I don't even know what to say, honestly. It's a movie called Captive State that my folks and I saw. And Eric saw it, and we're going to try to figure out a way to review it.
I'm curious now.
I don't know. I didn't understand any of it. Like, it's maybe the most incomprehensible movie I've ever seen in my life. And I just was at my folks and I afterwards, when it was over, we were all just like looking at each other going, what the hell was that? I mean, so shot right here in Chicago too. I don't know, but so anyway, we're gonna break here, and when we come back, Eric Childress will be here, and we'll try to make sense out of it, and we'll review the new movies, and we'll talk about the box office, and he'll tell us more about movies from the South by Southwest Film Festival. So that's all coming up, but we got a break here right now, and we'll do the movie reviews right after this.
Walk along Hollywood Boulevard. Some that you recognize, some that you hardly
Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago, here till 5 a.m. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a jokey time. That'll be coming up. We're going to talk about otherwise good movies, but with one absurd scene. Got a bunch of those. We got some iconic movie scenes that weren't planned and some casting decisions that made fans angry. A bunch of movie stuff that we're going to be talking about this morning. And speaking of movies, it is that time to review the new movies. Jim is off this week. Jim Leskowski is off this week. So it'll just be me and Eric talking about the new movies. And also, Eric will be telling us a little bit more about the rest of the movies that he saw at South by South. South by Southwest at the film festival. So and also Eric has got have an announcement about the Chicago Critics Film Festival, which is coming up in May. And let's welcome Eric back to the show. Hi, Eric.
Hello.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
Why don't we start with the announcement of the Chicago Critics Film Festival? Give everybody all the details when it is, and you guys have started to announce some of the titles, correct?
Yeah, on Friday we announced the first seven titles that we're going to be playing in the festival this year. It takes place, again, at the Music Box Theater from May 17th to the 23rd, and full passes are on sale right now at the Music Box Theater website, as well as the ChicagoCriticsFilmFestival.com website. So you know, get in on that, because those tend to go. We're really excited just with what we've announced so far, and we're really, you know, gearing up over the next 5 or 6 weeks or so and filling out the rest of the lineup and announcing the full schedule.
All right. And so what are some of the titles that you guys have released so far?
Well, some of the ones, some of these that we've talked about at Sundance, a movie called The Farewell with Awkwafina. That was a big favorite of mine at the festival this year, a favorite of a lot of people, actually. So that's going to be a real highlight of the festival. We're also showing a surprising film that none of us ended up seeing at Sundance, but we ended up getting a chance to see it afterwards. This really terrific movie called Light from Light stars Marin Ireland and Jim Gaffigan in a dramatic role about basically like a medium, like a ghost hunter legitimately goes into people's homes trying to not just find out information about potential ghosts that are living in their houses, but also just trying to discover for herself whether or not there is something to the all the talkings of the afterlife. It was a movie that just snuck up on all of us, and we can't wait for people to see it, because I think there's going to be a real emotional attachment to this movie, and Gaffigan is really good in it.
Okay. I like Jim Gaffigan a lot anyway.
Yeah.
So, all right, that's cool. What else?
The Nightingale, Jennifer Kent's follow-up to The Babadook.
Oh, boy.
We're going to be playing. Yeah, and if Light from Light makes them feel, you know, good, this one's going to, you know, knock them back in their seats.
Yeah, well, I will definitely be attending.
Yeah, you're going to love it.
Yeah.
You're going to love it.
Yeah.
We're also showing a film called Manos, a film that I did not see, but it's a kidnapping drama, kind of a Lord of the Flies type kidnapping drama that stars Julianne Nicholson. That got rave reviews at Sundance, and a couple of our critics was like one of their favorite movies. So we're going to be showing that. Them That Follow, which also has Jim Gaffigan in it, but it's a film about a Pentecostal preacher played by Walton Goggins and the kind of Romeo and Juliet type relationship that's going on in their compound. In Fabric is the new film from Peter Strickland, who did The Duke of Burgundy. Mm-hmm. It's a horror film set in it's basically if Phantom Thread was a horror film.
Okay.
Phantom Thread was a horror film, depending on your point of view.
Phantom Thread was kind of a horror film.
Kind of. Yeah. A little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then we are going to be playing on film 40th anniversary presentation, 35mm of Ridley Scott's Alien.
Wow, God, 40 years.
40 years.
Man, oh, man.
Yeah.
Wow. So, also, that would be I just thought about this. Then that would be the 40th anniversary of Phantasm, too, because they came out at the same time. I remember.
Mm-hmm.
It was a particularly good year for horror.
There's a lot of good. 79, pretty good year for a lot of horror and sci-fi and fantasy and a lot of great stuff that year.
So 35mm Alien, which would be, so that's great. Now, you've got the $150 passes that are available now, and that's all that's all access, correct?
Yeah, that's so the pass will get you into the entire program, so and first in line as well. So you people want going to want to scoop that up.
Okay, and so there you guys are going to announce more films, obviously. There's going to be special events, and then you guys always get directors and stars of the movies to show up, and I'm sure you guys are working on that as well.
Yeah, we're working quite hard on that, and we got really some real great possibilities this year that we're working on, that we're trying to work out some scheduling for, including some of the films that I just talked about. So fingers crossed for all of that. So probably sometime, probably in like mid to late April, give or take. We don't have a date set yet because we're always kind of fixing stuff up right up until the last couple hours. So so sometime mid to late April, we will announce the full lineup and the full schedule, which will be at the Music Box Theater.
Okay. And you can check it out at the Music Box Theater and the Chicago Critics Film Festival. It is May 17th through the 23rd at the Music Box. And I can't believe it, because it's just the 7th annual Critics Festival.
Can you believe that?
Wow.
Man, it's crazy.
Yeah, time just flies, man.
I know.
Wow, it's crazy. All right. So, okay, cool. Well, that's going. And go to the Music Box website for more information about that. And again, as things get scheduled, more announcements will be made on that website, and of course on here on the show too. We'll get Eric to talk about that as well. So, very exciting stuff. All right. Well, we got the box office a little bit later on, and then you got more movies to tell us about from the South by Southwest.
Mm-hmm.
All right, well, why don't we start here with now? I did not see Wonder Park, nor did I see 5 Feet Apart.
Yeah, me neither.
So the two movies that we are going to review, we both saw. These were the two that we saw.
Okay.
So why don't you start with Gloria Bell?
Okay, I think I might have talked about this from the Toronto Film Festival last year, but this is a remake. Same director, Sebastian Lillo, did a film called Gloria a few years ago, which I think played the Chicago International Film Festival. I think that might have been where I saw it. But he's remade it now, English language version, with Julianne Moore in the title role as a woman in her, basically turning over the 50s. On the calendar. She's divorced. She has a grown son, played by Michael Cera, and she discovers sort of a new passion in her life is going out to clubs and dancing. And one night at a club, she meets another divorcee, played by John Turturro, and they strike up a relationship. And that's basically kind of the driving force of this film. They each have some baggage that comes with it, with them. Julianne Moore's ex-husband, played by Brad Garrett, is kind of a bundle of emotions, a very uncomfortable dinner scene midway through the film. And John Turturro is still very, he has grown daughters and a very sort of needy ex-wife, and he still has a real attachment to them, and that causes complications within their relationship. So that's sort of the driving force of the plot.
Okay, hang on a second, Eric. We'll take a quick break, okay?
Okay.
And then we can jump into what we thought about the movie. We're talking about Gloria Bell. Eric, hang on. Talking about Gloria Bell. This is Julianne Moore's latest movie. It's out right now, and then we got one more movie to talk about, and then box office, and Eric will tell us all about some of the other movies he saw at South by Southwest Film Festival. So that's all coming up. We got a break here for the news, and we will get to that after. We'll get back to the movies after the news, right after this. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate Skyline studio, and we are here until 5 a.m. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke, because it's a jokey time. We're going to talk about good movies that have absurd scenes, some iconic movie scenes that actually weren't planned, and much more. On the movie side. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. 312-981-7200 for talk and text. You can also follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show and stay connected on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Nick D Show. It is Monday morning, and that means we review the movies. Jim Leskowski is off this week. He'll be back next week. But Eric Childress is here. We're going to talk about box office, and he's going to tell us a little bit more about some of the movies he saw South by Southwest Film Festival that he was at last week. But before the break, Eric told us about the plot to Gloria Bell, the new Julianne Moore film. Okay, Eric, let's continue.
Okay, so I gave you the basic story of the film. And, you know, anytime you get Julianne Moore and John Turturro together in a movie and you're going to make them the central relationship, you already got something going for your movie. Turturro hasn't had a role as good as this in some time. And Julianne Moore, who, you know, is almost incapable of giving, you know, an uninteresting performance, is quite good here as well. So the scenes between the two of them are really exemplary. I mentioned that the dinner scene in the middle of the film is kind of the centerpiece dinner sequence that's really awkwardly staged and really uncomfortable to watch, particularly for one of the characters. But I got to say that the third act of this film really kind of left a sour taste in my mouth, because there's behavior that one character indulges in just seemed really abrupt and out of place, even for an actual human being. It just seemed completely out of character for him, and it really kind of bothered me, because it just seemed like an easy setup for the Julianne Moore character to gain some sort of closure, so she can end up dancing to the Laura Branigan song by the end of the film, and we're not supposed to roll our eyes at that. I actually did quite heavily, and I couldn't, you know, walking away from the movie, you know, thinking about how much I liked the scenes between the two of them, and whatever was going to happen to these characters, I was completely involved in. To see that turn just didn't ring true for me. It seemed completely out of place, even with the baggage that character was carrying, and I walked away going, like, I don't really believe in where this film ended up going. I would say, you know, it's definitely worth seeing for the performances, but, you know, just be aware that it's going to take a turn, and I guess depending on how you're feeling about the movie at that point, you may root on one character and jeer another character, but that's not the way I wanted to leave this film.
Okay, it didn't bother me. I was with it pretty much all the way through until the end, and it's carried by these performances, because this cast is it's not just Julianne Moore and John Turturro. The rest of them, I mean, this is a really stellar cast. And everybody's very good at it. But the stuff between Julianne Moore and John Turturro is great. Now, they have never been in a movie. They're both in Lebowski, but they don't have any scenes together.
I was just thinking about that, trying to think. Like, they seem like they've probably been in like seven movies together.
That's what it feels like. I think Lebowski is it.
Right.
And again, they didn't have any scenes together. They have no scenes together because, you know, the Jesus is not in any scenes with her.
Right.
Man, they're good. I mean, well, that's because they're Julianne Moore and John Turturro. That kind of goes without saying that, you know, you get two of the best actors on the planet and put them into a movie and have that be the sort of the romantic element of the film. And Julianne Moore is really, I mean, the scenes with her and Turturro, because there are times when she just has, like, no patience. for Totoro. And, you know, and those scenes are hilarious, like really, 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 really funny. And there's a lot going on between the two of them. And, you know, all of the other supporting characters, I think, are interesting. And I was with it until the end. I can understand why you had the reaction that you had, Eric. But I was with it pretty much till the end, and I really liked it. And anytime you get a chance to see Julianne Moore, you know, just like, you know, eat up the scenery, which she does here, it's a joy. And just the, you know, the bouncing off the stuff with her and Totoro is great. So just I really enjoyed this movie. I was emotionally attached to it, and I can't even, you know, we could just go on and on and on about how great these actors are and how great
they're both kings and queens.
Exactly. So I'm recommending it. I'm recommending Gloria Bell. So
All right,
Eric.
You're making me do this, huh?
Yeah. Because can you attempt to
explain? Can we try this together?
I mean, we're talking about this movie. This movie, Captive State, is what it's called. Okay,
yeah.
And they're advertising it as some sort of like alien invasion movie. John Goodman's in it. Takes place in a futuristic Chicago that has that has payphones that take quarters.
That's right.
Should we attempt to even try to?
Yeah, because I think people need to understand why we're so confused by this movie.
Seriously, Eric, it could be the most incomprehensible film that I have ever seen in my life.
Yeah, and it's a fine line between incomprehensible and just flat out incompetent. And, this movie was supposed to screen for critics several weeks ago, and then they pulled the screening, and then they didn't screen it anywhere.
Yeah.
I'm surprised that maybe it was just going to be a Chicago thing because of the Chicago connection, but I watched this movie, and people are just like, well, it's not that bad. And I'm like, well, no, it kind of is.
Who says it's not that
bad? I get why they didn't screen it.
Who says it's not that bad?
I've seen many people say it's not that bad.
Are you kidding me?
Nope. They're not recommending it, but they said that it wasn't as bad as some of the movies that haven't been screened for critics.
Oh, my God. All right, well, let's attempt here at some sort of way to describe what this movie is about.
Well, you are correct in that it is an alien invasion movie, which is established in the first 5-6 minutes of the film with this exposition heavy prologue, where the aliens have come down and somehow, for some reason which is never fully explained, the human race capitulates to the aliens, just allows them to, you know, okay, you won, you know, surrender, you won. And not just that, you know, so it doesn't turn into like a kind of like a Falling Skies television show where it's just your V, for example, where, you know, the resistance, you know, you find out what the aliens are up to, you know, and it's certainly not a quiet place either where they've just wiped out all the humans and there's a few left and they have to survive. So it's like none of those movies, okay? Here, the human race has given up, and not just given up, but have decided to work with the aliens. I don't know how that works, but so they've decided to work with the aliens, and they have closed off certain sections of the United States and presumably the world for what they call closed zones. I don't really know what the purpose of the closed zones are, but okay. So Ashton Sanders from Moonlight plays a kid who, in the prologue, witnesses his parents murdered by the aliens. They laser blast their car, the two parents die, and him and his brother, you know, grow up orphans. So flash forward years later, Ashton Sanders is roaming the streets of Chicago. His brother is presumably dead. John Goodman plays a cop.
And, oh, by the way, and his older brother is like this hero. He's like a rebellion hero.
Right, he's Quato.
Yeah, who's
basically
right.
I'm just trying to help people out here.
Keep trying.
Yeah. So John Goodman is a cop, and he's, you know, like working with the aliens. He also has a side gig where he visits a prostitute in the closed zone, played by Vera Farmiga. Which is, like, baffled me because, like, she shows up in the first 10 minutes and then doesn't show up again for, like, an hour.
Yeah.
So I'm like, what the hell is going on with that?
Yeah.
And it just turns out to be a big piece, but whatever. But Goodman knows Ashton Sanders' character and is trying to find him, so maybe they could, they believe the brother might not be dead. Meanwhile, the movie just shifts in the second act to this giant resistance conspiracy plot to blow up something at Soldier Field,
right.
A rally at Soldier Field.
Right. All right, hang on, Eric. We got to continue.
Yeah.
We have to take a break.
Do we?
I got to take a break. All right, hang on a second.
Oh, God.
Eric Childress and I are trying to make sense of Captive State. I don't even know where. Seriously, I don't even know where to begin with this movie. But we'll try to clear it all up after we take a break here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here on WGN here till 5 a.m. It is a Monday morning, and that means my dad's going to tell a joke. We're doing the movie reviews right now. We'll talk box office. And then another of the final wrap-up report from Eric Childress, who was at South by Southwest Film Festival last week. And we'll get exclusive reviews of some of the movies that he saw. So let's welcome Eric back. Hi, Eric.
Hello.
All right, we're trying to make sense of this movie, Captive State.
Doing our best.
Trying. So,
yeah.
All right, so you said that, you talk about the second act of the movie where suddenly we're following these, a bunch of characters that are part of a rebellion, and they're going to put something on some guy's back. And then,
whom we've never met, by the way.
Exactly. You don't know who he is. I don't even know. I mean, he was a politician of some kind. There was a rally, like a unity rally at Soldier Field.
Yeah.
They were going to do like a sort of like an anti, like a sort of terrorist attack, blowing something up at Soldier Field. And I still don't know what.
Right.
Lots of shots of people walking down the street carrying suitcases.
Yeah.
And there's the nonstop suspenseful score throughout the entire movie. All right. So there's that.
Yeah. And I guess, for an alien invasion, considering that they managed to, make us give up, Chicago's remarkably intact.
Yeah.
I know this is, supposed to be a low budget film. It's supposed to be a different type of alien invasion movie. That's fine. That's all noble and stuff, but you got to have some ideas going for it.
Yeah.
I think it's
really funny though, is that they just keep mentioning Pilsen and Wicker Park throughout the entire.
Yeah, Pilsen. Oh my God. Pilsen. I mean, take a drink every time someone says Pilsen in the movie.
It's ridiculous.
Crazy.
And then like they destroyed Wicker Park. Wicker Park is just, what are we doing here in Wicker Park? At one point,
right.
The guy says,
do you remember Wicker Park? Remember what happened to Wicker Park? and I'm just thinking like that movie with Josh Hartnett. Like what's going on here?
Yeah. No. And it's really funny is because like, seeing this movie, because there were about eight people in the theater when we went, and obviously we'll go through the box office. Nobody saw this movie. And people were just like, at all the mentions of like Pilsen and Wicker Park and everything, it was just so forced. It was like,
hey, wink, wink, we know a couple Chicago locations.
Exactly. There's a couple of neighborhoods we've heard of.
Like, we know these two places and Soldier Field.
Oh, my God. Okay, so. All right, so now here's the other thing. When the movie does shift into this sort of like we're following these rebellion people around, Soldier Field and everything, the main character drops out. Like, he's gone.
Yes,
I mean,
he's
like,
gone.
The person that we're supposed to be following is like literally, they put him in a room at one point. He's in a room, and like the aliens somehow surround the room.
Yeah.
And he's in there for like
he's trapped. He's walled off from the rest of the movie, and just like audience, here's a new cast of characters for you. We're not going to tell you who they are or what connection they have to each other, but they're doing something, and it is like that whole sequence, which is really, I mean, it's like the whole second act of the movie practically. I just kept one of my favorite Mystery Science Theater lines is if we pretend what's happening, this is actually kind of exciting.
Yeah, no, I know, but everybody seemed very intense.
Yeah,
you know, everything was happening, and like I said, the score is nonstop. Like it's we're supposed to be like, oh my god, this is really suspenseful. What's going to happen to these characters? Even though I have no idea who they are, what they're doing, I don't know what the hell is happening in this movie. I mean, I seriously was sitting in the theater just like. My parents and I saw this thing together, and
oh god,
oh yeah, no. And when it was over, my dad goes, "What the hell was that?" And I'm like, "I have no idea."
Yeah, I mean, it seems like they're shipping people who are not capitulating to the aliens off someplace.
Yeah, and then
they don't explain any of that. So it's just like, all these people come to this rally at Soldier Field, and like, what is the benefit other than not going to this other place? Like, and is that going to make you cheering and all this kind of stuff? Like, the idea that the world, let alone Chicago, would just go like, okay, I guess we lost.
Yeah.
And then, none of that made any sense to me.
And I didn't know what the subplot with Kevin Dunn. I had no idea what the hell was going on there. I don't know what the relationship between him and Goodman was.
No.
I don't know what the hell Goodman was doing. I don't know. I mean, he's very, very serious in it.
Yes.
You know, he does not crack a smile throughout the entire movie, and he's wearing he's wearing very serious glasses.
Yep.
And I didn't know where his allegiance was. I didn't know what his motivation was. I have no idea what happened in the final scene of the movie. I don't understand. I had no clue. I don't know what's happening right now.
Well, I can explain that to you off the air, but I don't want to spoil anyone this experience.
Yeah.
His entire motivation is summed up in the last 5 minutes of the movie.
Right.
That basically everyone's connected. Whatever.
Wait, did Kevin J. O'Connor lose a bet? What is?
Well, in Chicago, it's legally obligated.
Exactly. And I mean, I love Kevin. You know, I have to find out what the hell happened with this movie because I know Kevin, so I can ask him and go, you want to explain this to me?
And there's a moment in the final act of the movie where John Goodman has to explain everything to the agency that he's a part of.
Right.
You know, and he's in this room, and all I kept thinking, I'm just like, is he playing the same character he played in Red State? Because you remember that in Red State, he does this entire speech, and it's great in Red State, because at least Kevin Smith's doing the dialogue, and it's kind of funny. But here, it's just like, and like it leads up to a reveal, and I'm just like, is he in trouble? Kevin Dunn gives like this look, like, oh my god. And then John Goodman's like, yeah, whatever.
I know.
I'm like, is he being punished? What's going on here?
I have no idea. I didn't know what was going on the entire movie. I swear to god, I sat there, I was like, What the hell is happening? I don't know. I don't know who, what's going on. I don't know what the situations are. I don't know who these characters are. I don't know what D.B. Sweeney shows up in one scene beating up a guy. And he's in one scene.
Yeah.
And so it leads me to believe that there is a longer version of this that maybe the director wanted to do that, because it feels like it's a movie that's been chopped up and like randomly put back together. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and given that this movie was supposed to come out last August, it's very possible that they did a bunch of changes to it. I mean, I thought at the time that it was like too close to A Quiet Place. They didn't want to, make that comparison.
Right.
People going there thinking this is going to be like full on alien resistance fighting. Think again.
No, that's not it. Nothing like that occurs. And the alien design is boring,
stupid,
and the, and the alien ship that just kind of floats above Lake Michigan a couple of times, and I was like, I was shaking my head trying to figure out what the hell was happening through this entire movie. Now, the director of this movie is Rupert Wyatt, who also co-wrote it, so he's got no one to blame but himself.
That's right.
And I really am, now I'm convinced that Rise of the Planet of the Apes was a fluke. There's no question about it, because he did the remake of The Gambler, which wasn't very good. What else did he direct?
There was a prison drama with Brian Cox, I think, called The Escapist.
The Escapist.
I think was the name of it.
Yeah.
The movie he did before Apes.
Yeah, and he directed a bunch of episodes, and he was executive producer and directed a bunch of episodes of The Exorcist, the TV show, which should also tell you, you know, what's going on there.
Right.
But this is just a complete disaster and mess, and I don't even know what to make of it. It barely qualifies as a movie. I had no idea what was happening throughout the entire movie. No.
And it is such a colossal waste of John Goodman.
Oh, my God.
I mean, finally gets above the line, you know, credit in a movie. And he's got the most screen time in the movie of any actor.
Yeah.
And it's so disappointing to watch him kind of. I mean, I bet he could tell. I'd like to hear from him, because he clearly signed on to this thinking that there was something to this.
Yeah,
and I bet there is a somewhat more interesting cut out there, because this thing is just an absolute chop job.
Yeah, I mean, it's ridiculous. And here's it's quite an accomplishment when you make John Goodman uninteresting.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Because it's almost impossible to not love John Goodman in any capacity, whether it's drama or comedy or whatever.
And Rupert Wyatt knows that, too, because he's so good in the Gambler remake that you mentioned.
Right, exactly.
Goodman's so good in that.
Yeah, he was the best thing in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, and then, like, Alan Ruck shows up. I don't know, was he just hanging out waiting for Ferris Bueller? I don't know.
Yeah, I think he was in town for a Ferris Bueller anniversary, and he's like, hey, we're shooting a movie.
I have no idea. And then there were like some actor people that I know that were in it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like that I've known through theater, because there's a ton of Chicago actors in this movie, because it was shot here, and I don't even remember them shooting this thing here.
Yeah, I don't remember that either. I honestly do not remember ever hearing that they were shooting. Like, it popped up on IMDb. I'm just like, oh, this is set in Chicago. Cool.
Yeah, yeah. I had no idea. So, again, apparently Goodman was in town filming this at some point. We don't know when.
Right.
I mean, it was supposed to come out last August. It was probably 3 years ago when they shot this thing.
Mm-hmm.
But, my God. I mean, I had no idea what was happening. And I'm telling you right now, when we were walking out of the theater, I saw this movie at the Village Crossing in Skokie.
Uh-huh.
And so when it was over, first of all, my parents and I were just looking at each other like, what was that? What was that?
And then, I mean, I have to believe, Nick, and you know, I hate bringing politics into our movie reviews at all, but I have to believe that somewhere in Rupert Wyatt's mind, when he either was writing this thing or when he was making it or editing it, that he, you know, like the idea of that, you know, that half a country is going to get around a force in this country that's, you know, is just not good for us.
Yeah.
I mean, that's because I'm watching that rally. I'm like, okay, there's an outdoor rally of this political figure. I wonder what that's supposed to mean.
Right. Well, it doesn't mean anything because none of it makes
right.
sense. All right. Well, listen, captive state, and nobody went to see it, and we'll talk about that. Eric, hang on, okay?
Okay.
All right. We did our best, everybody. Seriously, if you saw this movie over the weekend, you have absolutely every idea why Eric and I just struggled trying to figure out how to talk about Captive State, a movie that makes absolutely no sense. All right, well, we got more coming up right after this on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago, here until 5. It is Monday morning, and we are going to get a joke from my dad. We are going to talk about good movies that have absurd scenes, iconic movie scenes that actually weren't planned, and much more. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text, and you can also follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show and stay connected with us on Facebook. Facebook.com/Nick D Show. All right, Eric Childress is hanging out with us. We just finished reviewing a couple of movies, and we welcome Eric back. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right, let's talk about the box office, and then we'll jump into some South by Southwest movies.
Okay.
All right, Captain Marvel again. For its second weekend, $69 million. That's pretty good.
Yeah, it's very impressive. I mean, there's been 24 films in history that have made $60 million or more in its second weekend. So that movie is right up there. Now the question is whether or not it's going to reach $400 million, which was a milestone that I guessed it could possibly make. I suggested the Hunger Games numbers when we were talking about this weeks ago, and it's definitely got a shot. I mean, 20 of the 24 films that have achieved $60 million in the second weekend have gone on to gross $400 million or more.
Yeah,
and this is now the 17th Marvel property, not all in the cinematic universe per se, but the 17th Marvel property to gross over $750 million worldwide.
Wow,
and it is at $760 million already.
And people wonder why we get 12 comic book movies a year.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, I was wondering how the global box office was going to be on this, given that Wonder Woman is a far more famous character, more well-known character,
yeah.
And that only did like $400 million worldwide. So I was wondering, is this going to be like this kind of like a sexist thing going on? But apparently not. And I got to think that just Marvel knows exactly how to brand these things. And it might be something that DC is still behind the curve globally too, because how they couldn't get Wonder Woman to greater numbers with an international actress like that, it's kind of baffling. But Captain Marvel is about set to pass Wonder Woman globally at the box office.
Wow! All right. Well, I mean that's pretty amazing. It really is. I mean, obviously people are enjoying the movie. There's no question about it. Okay, so Wonder Park came in second with $16 million. Was that expected around those?
Yeah, it's a little less. I think it's suspect. I think some people were thinking even lower. Some people were thinking maybe in the low 20s. I mean, I was sort of thinking of somewhere around the teens, like 17, 18 million, which is not good. Cause this movie cost somewhere close to $100 million. People who don't know the history of this movie actually like started back in 2014. The director was fired for inappropriate conduct on the set, and the movie's actually been released without a director's credit.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I didn't even hear about this story. I had no idea what happened there.
Yeah, I guess in 2017, probably maybe right in the middle of all the Weinstein stuff that was happening, this came out that he had some inappropriate conduct with some women on the set, and he was fired, and they went forward finishing the movie without him, and the movie now opens without a director's credit.
Wow. Okay, that's an unusual thing right there.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, all right. And then number three was 5 Feet Apart with $13.1 million. That seems about right, correct?
Yeah. I mean, it's not going to certainly break any records, but, you know, the movie only costs $7 million, and if it's something that gets Haley Lou Richardson more work, I'm all for it.
Yeah. I'm really interested in seeing the movie mainly because of her.
Exactly.
Because she's so great.
Mm-hmm.
So, all right. And then four is How to Train Your Dragon, Hidden World, $9.3 million. It's only $135 million total.
Yeah, but over $466 million worldwide, so it's already in the profit.
Okay.
Domestically, it's not going to do as much as the second movie did, but it is a success.
Okay. Tyler Perry's A Medea Family Funeral, $8 million, that made $59 million total. These movies don't cost anything, right?
No, they don't cost much at all. I mean, he's gotten the budgets down for this, so it's down to like $20 million. So this one's going to be a success, and it looks like it's going to be the third highest grossing film of his career.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. He's not going to do Medea anymore, so...
After the number, these numbers, they might bring him back.
Yeah, maybe.
Or her back.
All right. And then number six is No Manches Frida 2.
$3.8 million. Part of Lionsgate's Pantaleone line of films. Basically did as much as the first No Manches Frida did a couple years ago, so it's kind of right on point.
Okay. Number seven, The Incomprehensible Captive State.
Yes.
$3.1 million.
Yeah, $3.1 million. This is actually the lowest grossing film for opening weekend for a wide release that Focus Features has ever released.
And they've released a lot of movies that didn't make any money.
Oh yes, they absolutely have. And you know, I mean, primarily they've platformed a lot of things. They open stuff in limited release and then platform them around Oscar time and stuff like that. But they have done more than their share of wide releases. And this one, you know, this is coming a couple weeks off of Greta, which a couple weeks ago I said that was the lowest that they ever had. Now this is, and it's actually, as people want to pay attention to per theater averages, it is the eighth worst per theater average in their history.
Oh my God.
Even amongst limited releases.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. And word of mouth is not going to help.
Oh no.
All right. Number eight is the Lego Movie 2, the second part. That just barely over 100 million.
Yeah, this is a bust. For Warner Brothers, this is their biggest bust in some time, and it's really unfortunate. I don't know what happened with this series. Why it just kind of just flatlined so quickly?
Yeah, I'm shocked by those numbers. I really am, considering how big the first one was.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's disappointing because it's such a good movie.
Yep.
All right. Number nine is Alita: Battle Angel. That's up to 81 million.
Yeah, still not a success for them.
Yeah. And then number 10 is Green Book, man. Just really chugging along.
Yeah, people still going to see it in theaters despite it actually coming out on DVD this past week.
Yeah, that's unbelievable. $82.6 mm-hmm. million. It really did get a boost for from the Oscars.
Yeah, who says people don't go see movies in theaters?
That's true. That's true. Mm-hmm. All right, here's your here's the question.
Yeah.
How much money is Us going to make next week?
It's a very good question.
I think it's going to make a ton of money.
Oh, I think a ton of money, yes. Just what do we define as a ton, though? Do we define it? Because Get Out did $33 million. It's going to be higher than that.
It will be higher than 30. There's no question about it. It'll be higher than 33.
But are we talking 60 or like 80? 80, we're getting in, you know, real high territory.
Yeah.
It's hard to say because, like I said, this is. I mean, people are going to be all up for this movie. The horror fans. I mean, this is a horror movie.
Yeah.
Okay. This is a horror movie. So it's going to even take some of the Get Out people probably off guard.
Yeah.
Word of mouth will be interesting too to see where it goes from there. But I'm thinking somewhere in the 60 to 70 million range.
Yeah, I don't think that's outrageous to think that. So many people are looking forward to this movie. You know, lots of people are really looking forward to it. I've been getting texts from friends and stuff saying, "Hey, have you seen Us yet?" And I'm like, "No, I'm going to see it when it opens on the weekend." And I think the numbers are going to be really huge.
I think they are too. And people are just like, "Is it going to outgross Get Out?" I'm like, I think it has. If it has a big enough opening weekend like that, it has a very good chance, because I think the people who really love this movie are going to go back for repeat viewings, because there's a lot to process the first time.
Yeah.
And you're going to want to go back and see how everything fits in the construct the second time.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
Yeah. Well, I cannot wait.
Yeah.
To see this again.
Yeah. Well, I'm very excited. Obviously, I'm way excited to see this movie. All right. So that's Us. That's what that's clearly will be number one next week. It's just a question of how much money is it going to make.
Yep.
All right. Okay. Eric, why don't we take a quick break? Okay.
Okay.
And then we come back. You got some South by Southwest movies to talk about, correct?
Yeah.
All right. Cool. All right. So Eric Childress is with us, and he goes to all the film festivals during the year. And he was he talked to us live from Austin last week at the South by Southwest Film Festival. Well, he's back, and he's got more movies to talk about from that festival. And we will do that after we take a quick break here on 720 WGN.
Some that you recognize, some that you hardly.
everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, the Monday Morning Movie Reviews with Jim Laskowski and Eric Childress. Jim is off this week, so it's just been me and Eric. We reviewed the new movies. We talked about the box office, but Eric just returned from the South by Southwest Film Festival, and he's giving us exclusive reviews of the movies that he saw down in Austin. All right, Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
Okay, now, overall, was it a good fest?
I would say about an average fest. This is the things that I saw, and a lot of the stuff that I really liked are actually really big premieres. That's some that we talked about last week. Many that are going to be coming out several months down the road. Pick up a few really nice discoveries, but there were a lot of disappointments on the back end too. A couple of which we'll cover here tonight. The good stuff is really good. And the bad stuff, pretty disappointing. Mm.
Okay, cool. Well, let's start. Where do you want to go?
Okay. Last week we talked about a bunch of these premieres I mentioned. Us, obviously, Long Shot, Booksmart, Olivia Wilde's film, which kind of really blew up at South by this year. But the one that we didn't get to talk about because it premiered Monday night is the movie Good Boys.
Okay.
Which is not opening until August, and this is the Seth Rogen, Evan Goldberg produced film starring the fantastic Jacob Tremblay as a trio of sixth graders with very filthy mouths who go on this crazy day adventure. Like Booksmart, some people might make a comparison to Superbad, that involves Jacob Tremblay really wanting to go to this popular party that's also going to be a kissing party so he could kiss the girl that he's in love with. But along the way, they have encounters with some really strange characters, including a pair of teenage girls that have unwittingly let them take their aspirin bottle full of drugs with them, and it's a whole procedure getting the drugs back and whether or not, all this kind of stuff. So it sounds like a stunt movie. Let's take the most adorable, greatest child actor of his generation and put him in the good son. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
But this is a comedy. It's a full-blown comedy, and it sounds like a stunt. Sounds like let's put Jacob Tremblay and make him do South Park.
Right.
But this movie is so funny and really has so much heart to it. People who might think that they're going to be uncomfortable watching these six, people who were ever in sixth grade, they know how kids talk.
Yeah.
I'm sure you and I are both sailors in sixth grade.
Oh yeah.
So you have these kids together, and even the stuff that you might squirm at, the fact that they're carrying around drugs. Let's just say that the fact that they're carrying around drugs in a aspirin, a childproof cap thing that they can't get off. Okay, so it's stuff like that, and there's all kinds of like these kids. Other than their mouths, are completely pure and innocent. There's all kinds of, messages about consent and drugs and, friendship. It fits right into those movies, like Superbad and other things where, if a friendship is really sort of the key thing. And here that you got sixth graders involved, there's actually, it's at this point in their lives where they start to realize that maybe these friends aren't going to be my friends forever. But they're still the best friends ever at the time. And I found this movie I laughed so hard throughout this movie. And it's really funny. It's moving at times. Jacob Tremblay is the king. But there's an actor, one of the boys is played by an actor named Kevin L. Williams, who just about steals this movie. He had two line readings in the movie that I doubled over hurting with laughter in the film. I'm looking forward to people seeing this movie. I can't wait to see it again. I want to show it to people. It just made me laugh so hard. The movie called Good Boys.
Okay, so that's Good Boys. Doesn't open here until August.
Yeah.
So we got a little ways to go. All right. Sounds like it's going to be funny, man. Sounds like it. I mean, it looks something that I would look forward to. I'll tell you that.
Yeah, and I mean, the director of the movie is Gene Stupinski and Lee, I think Eisenberg, is his last name, and they were writers on The Office and Hello Ladies.
Yeah.
So they got really good pedigrees in television. Their movies don't look up their screenplays. I'll just say that.
Okay.
But the Hello Ladies and The Office, they did some really great stuff, and they do it here again with Good Boys.
Okay. All right. Okay. What else did you see at South by Southwest that you want to mention?
A movie called Run This Town. They didn't tell you a lot about what this movie is. I mean, here's what the basic line of the movie is. It says, "The inner workings of a city seen through the eyes of the interns and assistants that run it."
All right.
Okay, that's what it says on IMDb in the South by Southwest program book. It's basically about this kid who graduates and wants to become a journalist. He gets a job at a local Canadian newspaper, kind of the low rung. He gets to do really bad, lame stories and things like that. And he's looking for his big break. And then he comes across a potential video that's out there of the local Canadian mayor smoking crack.
Mm.
And that's where you go, oh, it's this movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's the Rob Ford story.
Okay, all right.
Okay, mm-hmm. As told through the eyes of the journalists and interns who run the city. Okay, if you don't, do you know who plays Rob Ford in this movie?
I'm looking at it now and I can't believe it.
Right.
I'm looking at the IMDb page now. How is that possible?
A lot of makeup.
That Damian Lewis plays Rob Ford.
Yeah. And I got to say, Damian Lewis is, again, the king.
Yeah.
And, he seems incapable. I mean, I like him in Dreamcatcher.
He's great in Dreamcatcher.
Yes, he's great in it.
Yeah.
Yes. He seems incapable of giving an uninteresting performance. And he's good. He's very good as Rob Ford. The makeup, though, makes him look like Fat Bastard from Austin Powers.
Oh, no.
Yeah. I just, the whole movie, I'm just, get in my belly the entire time watching him. But he's so good, it's momentarily forget about that.
Right.
As for the movie, because he's only a supporting character in this story. This is about the race to whether or not someone's going to get the video, produce the video, put the video out there in the ether, and... It's a movie directed by a young director who bit off a bit more than he could chew with this story. You could tell right away it's very ambitious. The opening scene, it's overlapping dialogue, and he's using split screens and introducing multiple characters and all this kind of stuff. Much better than Captive State, I'll say that much. Mm. But just the whole movie feels over-directed, and there's very... there's like not a likable person in the entire movie. Even the lead journalist, the kid who's in, I forget his actor's name, but he's in Pitch Perfect, and I actually saw him in Book of Mormon here in Chicago. Good actor, but just the character is so unlikable, and he's the kind of journalist that all the adults in the room have to go like, dude, you don't have the story. You don't have it. You can't do this. Jennifer Ellie plays the editor of the paper, and she's the best thing about the movie, save for Damian Lewis, because she's at least trying to keep this kid, in his lane. I just wish she had done it for the director, too.
Mm. Okay. All right, so that's Run This Town. Was this picked up or anything?
Not yet.
Okay.
Not yet, but given that, just the curiosity of Damian Lewis as Rob Ford, someone will probably take a stab at it.
Yeah. Okay. All right, let's get another one in here.
Okay, actually, a local production.
Okay,
we've had a couple over the years. We've had some, Chicago doesn't seem to make it into Sundance much, but South by Southwest is very good to them. And there's a film called St. Francis, and the star of the movie, Kelly O'Sullivan, who also wrote the film. She plays one of these, like a 30-ish, mid-30s female in Chicago, doesn't really have a job, doesn't really have a great direction in life. Not a, you know, a bad person or anything like that, but just is kind of missed out on her opportunities. And she ends up getting a job as a nanny to kind of a upper middle class lesbian couple, and the movie is about the relationship between not just her and the young girl that she watches over, but really a loving relationship with a guy she met that leads to some complications in her personal life, as well as also just trying to. The minefield of the kind of the postpartum depression that's actually going on within the house that she resides under for half of her day now.
Okay. All right, Eric, hang on.
Sure.
Hang on a second. Eric's going to tell us more about actually a film that was shot here, made here, St. Francis, which he saw at South by Southwest, and we'll get more about that right after we take a break here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Monday morning. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke. We got to talk about some good movies that have absurd scenes and iconic movie scenes that actually weren't planned. Happy accidents. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. And Eric Childress is with us. Telling us all about some of the movies that he saw at South by Southwest. And before the break, Eric was telling us about a movie called St. Francis. So, Eric, go ahead.
Okay, I was describing this film. We've kind of seen movies like this many times like this before. Directionless lead character, kind of finds meaning in through her experiences with others, especially when there's a child involved. St. Vincent, for example, with Bill Murray, is a film kind of like that. Obviously, a much older character, but this one has a lot of heart. It really does. It's really nicely acted. Kelly O'Sullivan's very good in the lead role. The young actress who plays the child in the movie is a package of adorable, and is really good too. And it's a movie that doesn't feel like just a package of cliches. It feels like there's real heart, genuine emotion in it. The characters don't just feel like one note caricatures on the paper. It takes, turns, weird turns through life, that are unexpected and the kind of things that, life brings us. So it doesn't feel like something that's just kind of manufactured. It feels something, kind of lived in. So I enjoyed it very much, and it's a real crowd pleaser.
Okay, cool. All right. And, has that one been picked up or anything?
Not yet.
Okay.
Not yet, but again, local production, from what I understand, just like everyone except like two people involved in the entire production are from Chicago.
Good.
Yeah.
That's nice. All right, mm-hmm. Cool. All right, where do you want to go next?
Where do I want to go next? Let me tell you about another good one I saw. This is probably the biggest surprise I saw at the festival. It's a movie called Olympic Dreams.
Okay.
And it was shot in the background of the Seoul, the Korea, the Winter Games, an actual Olympian, now turned actress and writer, she actually wrote this film as well, named Alexi Pappas, plays a cross-country skier. She's, alone at Olympic Village. She doesn't really know anyone, doesn't really have any friends, very early on in the film, we see her competition. Things don't go great for her, and then it's just basically a lot of sitting around waiting. Like, what do you do when everything you worked up to in your life, turns out to be less than stellar. And then you have to sit around and think about it for several days, away from home, away from everyone you know. But interesting enough, there is a dentist at Olympic Village played by Nick Kroll.
Mm.
He is also in the same boat, doesn't really know anyone. He just keeps trying to make friends with all the Olympians by giving them cavity advice and everything. And he ends up making friends with this young woman. He has a fiance back home. And she's very lonely. So there's definitely a Lost in Translation feel to this film. It's very inescapable, and that's clearly an inspiration for this film. But the two lead performances by Alexi Pappas and Nick Kroll are really fantastic. I don't think Nick Kroll has ever been better in a movie before. And it's while he does gets to do some laugh lines, this is not a comedic performance in the slightest. It's the most vulnerable I've ever seen Nick Kroll on screen before. It really kind of floored me, I think, how good he is in this movie. Alexi Pappas is the star of the movie. She matches him all the way through. This was one that really, I really felt this movie. This was a real special piece of work. And again, the Lost in Translation comparisons are going to be there, but focusing on the two lead performances, it's hard to say that it's just a mere copycat.
Okay, cool. So that's Olympic Dreams. Very cool. I've always been a fan of Nick Kroll's. I think he's great. I would love to see him do some serious stuff, you know?
I've come around, because I've liked what he's been doing in films recently. I really like My Blind Brother. Like, I thought he was really good in that.
Yeah, he was really terrific.
But he's always been, like, every time I see Nick Kroll, I think, well, there's Nick Kroll.
Yeah.
You know, and now then you're seeing these performances that he's doing, it's nice to see him kind of shed, the goofball that we know and love.
Right.
From him, and as I'm telling you, I'm watching this and I'm like, man, he's good in this movie.
All right, very cool. Very cool. Okay, that's Olympic Dreams. All right, where do you want to go next?
Let's see. Let's go to a film called The Day Shall Come.
Okay.
And this is the new film from Chris Morris, who did Four Lions.
Oh, sure.
Several years ago. Yeah. If people have not seen Four Lions, put that on your radar immediately.
Great movie.
Yes. And this one has very similar overtones and undertones to Four Lions. It deals with a kind of a makeshift urban family that is kind of trying to start their makeshift revolution. Things are just not going well. They don't have the funding for it. They don't, the main character might be a little mentally unstable. Maybe not dangerous, but maybe a little mentally not there. around the bend is the FBI. One of them played an agent played by Anna Kendrick. They concoct a scheme to sort of boost up their own profiles, that if they can get this makeshift family kind of on the radar of the FBI and sort of trick them into actually committing a crime, that the FBI's profile will be boosted. It'll look like they're actually doing something on the war on terror, and this family is going to go to jail. So, again, very similar overtones and undertones to Four Lions.
Mm-hmm.
It actually feels at times like Chris Morris didn't get the reaction he wanted to out of Four Lions, and therefore had to redo it in a different way and do it with more mainstream actors. I mean, Riz Ahmed, obviously, back then, people didn't really know who he was.
Yeah.
But now they got Anna Kendrick front and center with this, and then maybe he can get some more butts and seats with this one. And I think it's good. I think it's a good film. It doesn't quite have the same bite as Four Lions did. It's definitely an angrier film, so it's not as outright funny. And I think there are times when he's almost trying to do like an Armando Iannucci kind of style, especially with involving the scenes with the FBI, the kind of an absurdist stuff, and they're all insulting one another. And the problem I had with that is that a couple of the actors in the FBI scenes are not very good.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So watch
I think we're losing Eric. Are you Eric? Yep, we lost Eric. All right. We can get him back on real quick. Okay. All right, Eric, continue. You were talking about the day shall come.
Oh, yeah. Hey, I'm sorry. I was on one of those payphones in Chicago. yeah, so, like, very, you know, watching the movie, you know, watching even him kind of take some of the same beats on the finale even is very similar to what occurs in Four Lions. But, you know, Anna Kendrick, again, just seems incapable of being uninteresting, particularly in comedic roles, and she's really good in this film, as are the actors who play the people who are trying to be part of this crazy conspiratorial plot that they have no business being a part of. It definitely gives you something to kind of make you go about at the end of the film, the way that minorities can be exploited for gains within the government.
Okay. All right. Well, okay, look, Eric, why don't we take a quick break and we come back a couple more titles, okay?
Okay.
All right. Eric Childress is with us. We'll take a quick break, and when we come back, he'll tell us a couple of more movies that he saw at South by Southwest this year. And we'll do that right after we break. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we're talking with Eric Childress on this Monday morning. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke a little bit later on. We got a bunch of other stuff coming up. 312-981-7200 for talk and text. Eric Childress is back. All right, Eric, a couple more movies that you saw in Austin this year.
Okay. One film that I think you might be interested in hearing about is called The Weeknd.
Okay.
And the reason you'd be interested in hearing about it is that it actually stars Sasheer Zamata from Saturday Night Live. Of Saturday Night Live.
Okay.
Yeah, and in the movie, she plays a stand-up comedian who's not exactly having a great love life. She ends up going with her ex boyfriend and current kind of best friend to her parents' cabin up in the country. But he has decided to invite his current girlfriend along for the trip. You know, why she thought that that wasn't going to happen, it's never quite that clear. But they end up going to get all together. And there's another gentleman at the house that she begins to take an interest in as well. So there's all kinds of weird friends dancing around, the love triangle and stuff. And there's a very kind of my best friend's wedding vibe to it, where she is almost kind of trying to sabotage the relationship a bit. And which is fine. I actually like that movie very much. But this movie is populated with... I said that the characters in Run This Town were unlikable. I hated every single person in this movie.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. This was probably the biggest shocking disappointment for me at the Fest. I was really looking forward to this. Not just for the prospect of Zamata getting something to do that she never got to do on Saturday Night Live, more than 4 minutes of screen time.
Yeah.
But it got really good reviews out of Toronto. It was really premiered at the Toronto Film Festival, and I missed it. And I thought that I missed the gem.
Yeah.
I didn't. I really kind of hated this movie, and I particularly hated Zamata's character. I don't think she is sympathetic at all. Her stand-up kind of sucks. You can not even like her professionally in the movie. What she kind of does to the characters. Her mom is horrible in this movie. She's not a likable character. The only one who's even remotely human is the other guy that's in and just kind of gets caught up in this.
Yeah.
And he wisely leaves. He's like, I'm getting out of here. This is ridiculous.
All right.
Yeah, so by the end of it, I was just like, man, I was shocked how much I really disliked this movie.
All right, so that's The Weeknd, very disappointing. Okay, one more here.
One more. One of the better horror films. There's still a couple of horror films I'm still looking to catch up with, including kind of a a semi-sequel to Lucky McKee's The Woman.
Uh-oh.
Called Darlin'. Yeah, Pollyanna McIntosh, who played the woman in The Woman, I haven't seen this movie, but she plays the woman, and I guess it's her and the daughter that she takes, and she directed the movie as well.
Okay.
So I'm waiting to get a fresh link on that so I can see that, and I'd like to report that to you. But one of the better midnight films I saw is a film called Daniel Isn't Real.
Okay.
I was skeptical going into this movie because it's the story of a guy who had kind of witnessed a traumatic event as a child and invented a imaginary friend. His mom is actually played by Mary Stuart Masterson, and she kind of has a mental breakdown throughout the course of his childhood. So he bonds with this imaginary friend, who he sees, physically manifested throughout the film. And as he grows older and, things have not quite, the confidence in his own life isn't quite there, he through the advice of his therapist, kind of reconjures the imaginary friend, who's played by Patrick Schwarzenegger, Arnold's son.
Okay.
And he's the dashing, confident alpha male character that he really wants to be, and it helps him out for a while. It gets him a new girlfriend played by Sasha Lane. He's just more confident and manly and all the things that you would hope for, but the imaginary friend wants a little more than the other guy, the real guy, wants to give.
Right.
And the first half of the movie, the movie is actually pretty visually pretty interesting. It's not just kind of I thought this was actually going to be a little bit more of a comedy horror movie, which it definitely is not. It actually kind of takes its themes pretty seriously, which I thought was a nice surprise. And I think the first half is pretty good because it actually deals with this idea of toxic masculinity and stuff that's so prominent these days. The second half gets a little more problematic. It's a little weirder. It's visually, it gets a little gorier in the second half, and then it betrays its themes a little bit by making everything a little bit more supernatural in nature rather than just an idea, a metaphor. When it gets a little more supernatural, it gets slightly less interesting. But Patrick Schwarzenegger, it's very hard not to watch Arnold in him a little bit.
Yeah.
But he's good in the movie. It's definitely an interesting film. Like I said, it wasn't a great crop of midnight selections this year. The good one, the two that I hear were quite good, including Darling, I haven't seen.
Okay.
And the other one has CM Punk in it.
Okay.
And also a Chicago film called Girl on the Third Floor. I heard very good things about both of those movies. But Daniel Isn't Real, of the ones that I saw, was the best one.
Okay. All right. That's Daniel Isn't Real. All right, Eric. I appreciate you covering all these movies for us, man. And we will talk to you next week to talk about Jordan Peele's Us.
Oh, we're going to talk all about Us.
It's going to be great. Okay. All right. Thanks, Eric.
Thank you.
There you go. Eric Childress, everybody. We'll take a break here on 720 WGN.
The numbers are in.
WGN Plus is where Chicago comes for podcasts.
Here's what's going on with WGN Plus. The Prickly City podcast is getting quite nervous these days. Or are they? Is it just a ploy? Is this all a lie? Getting Zen with Gen Z wants you to stop holding yourself back from achieving your goals. And the Corner Store is geeking out over a legend in the underground hip-hop scene here in the city, Sharkula. Look him up. WGN Plus on iTunes and Google Play.
All right. Hey, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. So after the news, which is coming up in just a couple of minutes, we're going to jump into iconic movie scenes that weren't planned. So some lucky mistakes here. Some really famous movie scenes just kind of happened. They weren't planned, and they just kind of happened, and they've turned out to be, sort of legendary. So we're going to be talking about that, and my dad's going to call in and tell a joke. And if you want to jump in at any time, it's 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200 for talk and text. Also, we are going to talk about otherwise good movies but have maybe one or two absurd scenes in them. Not every movie is perfect. So that's coming up. Again, 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Really quickly, my next film club is Alfred Hitchcock's The Man Who Knew Too Much with Jimmy Stewart. And it's on Tuesday, April 9th. It's $10 to get in. Parking is free. It starts at 8 o'clock. It's over at the AMC Rosemont 18. And I hope you guys can make it out. It's very rare to see this kind of this movie on the big screen like that. And I'm very excited. I've never seen it on the big screen. I've seen it many times, but I've never seen it on the big screen. So I'm very, very excited about this one. So get your tickets now. They're on sale right now. You can reserve your seats right now. AMC Rosemont 18. Go to amctheaters.com. amctheaters.com. Reserve your seats right now. They'll be waiting for you on Tuesday, April 9th. Movie starts at 8. I'll introduce it, and then we'll talk about it afterwards. And stop by, have some dinner beforehand at Murray Brothers Caddyshack Restaurant, which is right down the street. And they offer the film clubbers 15% off on all their food. Great food, great place, really cool. So go in, have some dinner at the Caddyshack Restaurant, get your 15% off the food, and then come on over and see Alfred Hitchcock's The Man Who Knew Too Much. And again, it's Tuesday, April 9th. $10 to get in for the movie. Parking is free. And reserve your seats right now at amctheaters.com. amctheaters.com. Hey, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago, here until 5 o'clock. It's Monday. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time, and much more. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk or text, and we're going to be talking about some sort of classic movie scenes that were happened by mistake. They were totally unplanned. And they've turned into, like, iconic movie moments. And if you know about any of these, you want to share your story or your thoughts around any of this, it's 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. And these are all true and moments that became classics in movies that were unplanned, if you want to jump in. Like, for instance, we'll start off with Apocalypse Now. According to the script for Apocalypse Now, Colonel Kurtz was a lean, mean fighting machine, but Marlon Brando arrived on set. He weighed more than 300 pounds. He says, I can't get a Super 4X Green Beret combat costume to Francis Ford Coppola moan. To hide the actor's girth, Coppola and cinematographer Vittorio Storaro dressed Brando in black pajamas and shot the movie scenes mostly in shadow, which wound up adding to Kurtz's aura of mystery and madness. You ever see the documentary Hearts of Darkness?
I have not.
Which is about the making of Apocalypse Now?
No, I've heard about it.
It's the making, the way that this movie was made is completely insane. The set was nuts. Mm-hmm. The set was completely nuts. And this was even before Brando showed up. And then Brando shows up. He weighs over 300 pounds. He didn't memorize any of his lines. Didn't know any of his lines. There was all kinds of crazy partying on the set. The movie went way over budget. It was supposed to be like a 2-month shoot or something. It ended up being 10 months.
Oh, wow.
Even longer than that. Martin Sheen had a heart attack on set and almost died.
I knew that one.
And it was just absolute chaos, the whole thing. And they didn't have an ending for the movie. And if actually, you know, if you see Apocalypse Now, it feels like it doesn't have an ending. Because the last third of Apocalypse Now makes me kind of nuts. Still, I mean, there's amazing stuff in it. But, like, Brando makes me crazy in the movie. I don't think Brando... But this documentary, Hearts of Darkness, is astonishing. Because, you know, there were cameras following Coppola around, you know, during the making of this movie, and it's insane the kind of stuff that he actually said in, you know, with cameras around him. Like, he was on the phone talking about Martin Sheen saying that, you know, something along the lines, because now, you know, they had to delay the shooting of the movie because the main star of the movie just had a near fatal heart attack. Yeah. And he had to recover. So Coppola's actually on screen screaming into the phone. I can't remember who he's talking to, like somebody who works in a production company or something, and says, you know, Martin Sheen can't die until I say he can die. Like, literally, he's like out of his mind. Coppola lost his mind. He lost his mind. And so by the time, you could just see by the time Brando shows up and just is giving Coppola the hardest time you could possibly imagine. Like, I don't feel like working anymore. Like, he would improvise all of his stuff and then just suddenly go, I don't feel like working anymore. And he'd walk off the set and Coppola would just be, you know, there's millions and millions of dollars are going down the toilet here. And so could his career. Yeah, so but the movie turned out, obviously, it turned out to be a classic, you know. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so that all that stuff, that the Brando stuff, was just improvised on the spot because he refused to. Brando was one of those guys. Later in his career, he would have his dialogue, because he wouldn't remember his lines. He wouldn't get off book, and so he would have his dialogue like taped to certain parts of the set. So that he could just read the lines.
Yeah.
And, you know, The Godfather, most of his dialogue was just, like, written and put in front of him.
Yeah.
And it's a great performance, though. You know, I mean, he won the Academy Award for it and then refused it. they didn't refuse it. He sent the actress who was playing a Native American to accept for him. But, yeah, and there was a... he made a movie with Robert De Niro and Edward Norton called The... The Score. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
The Score. And Edward Norton was like, oh, this is a dream come true.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I get to work with Brando and De Niro. This is, you know, this is unbelievable. This is the most exciting thing. So he's doing a scene. It's like his second scene or something with both of them in the scene. And he's freaking out, you know, because it's, you know, here's Edward Norton, who's, you know, who clearly idolizes these two guys and clearly is a method actor himself. And so he's very excited and he's sitting in between De Niro and Brando. And Brando hated, the director was Frank Oz. And Frank Oz, for those people who might not know, he's part of the Muppets. He's the voice of Miss Piggy. He's the voice of Yoda. So Brando had no respect for him at all. Like, had no respect. You was calling him Yoda and Miss Piggy. Wouldn't talk to him directly. Wouldn't take direction from Frank Oz. Had to have a mediator come in because he says, I'm not going to listen to Miss Piggy. So it was just on the set was weird. So at one point, Edward Norton tells this story about how he's sitting on a couch in between these two legends. And he looks over to his right and De Niro's asleep. Just like, he's out, mm-hmm. sleeping. He looks over to his left, and Brando is just pouring wine on his own chest. So he's like, I'm sitting, you know, these are my two idols here. One guy's asleep, and the other guy's pouring wine on his chest, you know, because at this point, you know, these guys, like De Niro and Brando, is like, whatever, man. You know, we've been around for so many years, and it doesn't matter anymore. But I love that story because it was like a dream come true for Norton, and then he's just kind of sitting between these two goofballs. But yeah, so another unplanned movie scene comes from E.T. Nowadays, product placement is all the rage, but not every company gets excited about seeing their goods in movie scenes. According to the screenplay for E.T., Elliot was supposed to woo the tiny alien into his home using M&Ms, not Reese's Pieces. But Mars, the maker of M&Ms, balked at the opportunity. And then when Hershey agreed to let its candy be used, no one at the company had yet to see the movie in its entirety. The subsequent promotional tie-in campaign was the biggest in Hershey's history, and sales of that stuff tripled in the first 2 weeks of the film's release. And my guess is that whoever made the decision at Mars to pass on that didn't have a job very long after that.
Oh, yeah.
That would be my guess, is that, yeah, nice job turning down, nice job turning that down. That's always been one of my favorite stories about, you know, the fact that it turned out to be Reese's Pieces, is that I really don't know what happened to the person who made that decision, but my guess is that they didn't work for Mars much longer.
I'm going to investigate that one.
Because,
I'm curious.
I don't, yeah. I mean, just one of the dumbest decisions. only turned out to be the biggest movie ever made at that time.
I will say, in my opinion, Reese's Pieces are way better.
I'm
a Pieces fan. That's my movie snack of choice.
I like Reese's Pieces. I think they're good. I think it's really tasty. I actually prefer them to M&M's, too. But obviously, M&M's were the bigger candy at that time. I mean, in terms of, like, popularity, which is why they turned it down. They were like, oh, we don't need some stupid alien movie. And then all of a sudden, Reese's Pieces goes through the roof. So, Taxi Driver. Now, this is a classic one. This is a classic one because a lot of people know this. I think a lot of people know this already. But the most famous line in Taxi Driver, all that you talking to me, that was improvised. That was just De Niro. Screenwriter Paul Schrader envisioned Taxi Driver Travis Bickle as an unstable vigilante who descends into madness. Much of Taxi Driver's dialogue was intentionally vague, giving the actor room to improvise. In fact, according to the script, at one point Travis simply, quote-unquote, speaks to himself in the mirror in one of the classic movie's most famous scenes. In preparing for the role, Robert De Niro debated Travis's actions and articulations with director Martin Scorsese for hours. Scorsese set up the mirror scene such that De Niro spoke into the camera. He posed and preened, he twirled his gun, and he muttered, "You talking to me," with increasing urgency. And the movie scene became one of the most quotable movie moments in film. And it was all improvised. All of that stuff, "You talking to me," all of that stuff was improvised. And it's gone down in history as one of the most classic moments in movie history. Let's see. Here's Trucker Rich. Hi, Rich.
Hey, how you doing tonight, Nick?
All right, what's up?
The opening scene of American Graffiti where Toad crashes his moped scooter into the garbage can, that was totally unplanned, but he physically did lose control of it.
Oh, he did?
And crashed, yeah, and they left it in because it kind of indicated what kind of a nerd, dweeb, awkward kid he was.
Yeah. Yeah, and you then know, he ended up rear-ending another car in the movie, too.
So, well, he backed into it
back
in reverse.
Yeah, that's right.
Going to do a burnout and impress the chick in the car next to him and back into the car in front of him or behind him. But, yeah, but that scene was unplanned where he lost control of the scooter and they decided to leave it in just because it was funny and led into his character.
That makes sense. Yeah, that makes sense. Oh. All right. Thank you, Rich.
Right. Yep. Have a good evening.
See ya. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Again, some of these iconic movie moments, it's amazing how "You Talking to Me" has become one of the biggest movie quotes of all time, and De Niro just kind of came up with it in the moment. And that's what we're talking about here, moments that took place in movies. They weren't planned. They were unplanned, and they turned out to be some iconic moments in movies. 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you would like to jump in with your thoughts on this. We'll take a quick break, and then we'll come back with more here on 720 WGN. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here on a Monday morning. And Monday morning meaning my dad will call in and tell a joke. And our phone number is 312-981-7200. We're talking about iconic movie moments that were unplanned, iconic movie scenes that have gone down in history as some really amazing movie moments, and they weren't planned. We're talking about, De Niro improvised, "You Talking to Me," that whole thing, was improvised. We had Apocalypse Now, Brando showed up weighing over 300 pounds. And, now here's another one that, is an iconic moment that was not planned. Living in England and petrified of flying, filmmaker Stanley Kubrick, this is for The Shining. Filmmaker Stanley Kubrick did not get to examine the hotel in Oregon where The Shining's exteriors were filmed, nor was he familiar with Ed McMahon's famous catchphrase from The Tonight Show, starring Johnny Carson. Here's Johnny. So, in the movie, the scene where Nicholson shouted it while squeezing through the broken door, attempting to kill his wife, played by Shelley Duvall, Kubrick nearly axed it out completely. All told, the scary movie scenes took 3 days to be filmed, with Nicholson chopping down at around 60 doors, and Duvall going through over 125 takes. The intensity took its toll. Duvall lost clumps of her hair from stress. That is, it's a true story. Kubrick was brutal on Shelley Duvall in that movie. Like, she was very, very close to having a nervous breakdown, and there's no exaggeration on that. I mean, he put her through hell on that show, and in that movie, and she did. She lost clumps of hair. She couldn't sleep. She was completely stressed out. And if you watch her performance in that movie, Shelley Duvall's performance in that movie, it's really a great performance, because that's the way she was actually feeling. Like, she didn't really have to act that much in The Shining because of what she was going through, and, you know, 150 takes here, and Kubrick, like, being really mean to her and stressing her out and making her do things over and over and over and over again and yelling at her. And just the character that Nicholson, you know, plays in it, and how weird he is in the movie, and how intense he is in the movie. It really took its toll on her. It really did, and it made her a nervous wreck, and you can see it in the movie. I mean, that performance is just like all the shaking and the crying and all that stuff. That was real. That was real. So, really crazy set that was. So, 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Let's see. Here's Steve on WGN. Hi, Steve.
Hey, Nick, I got a couple. First one is Conan the Barbarian, when Schwarzenegger hits the camel. That was completely unscripted.
Okay, I don't remember the scene, but all right.
Okay. And the second one is Raiders of the Lost Ark, when Harrison Ford gets tired of this guy whipping around at him, and he just pulls his gun out and shoots him.
Right. Yeah, well, that was the story behind that one, Steve, the scene that we're talking about in the movie is this big swordsman comes out in Raiders, in the first Indiana Jones movie in Raiders. This badass, like, swordsman with a turban comes out and starts, like, whipping around the sword, like, doing all kinds of, like, crazy moves with the sword. And Harrison Ford just pulls out his gun, shoots him, kills him. Well, the reason why that is in the movie, the reason why that it happened, is because Harrison Ford was suffering from dysentery. Like, he was sick. You know, they were in Tunisia, and he ate some food or drank some water or something that really got him sick. He had dysentery, and they had a really elaborate sword fight choreographed. Like, they had, they choreographed this really elaborate sword fight that he was supposed to have with this character. Really long, elaborate sword fight. But on the day of the shoot, Harrison Ford was so sick that he couldn't do anything, and so, you know, Harrison Ford came up to Spielberg and he says, can I just pull my gun out and shoot the guy? And Spielberg's like, yeah, okay. Cause because of the dysentery, because of the fact that Harrison Ford was sick, and he threw this suggestion at Spielberg, and Spielberg said, yes, it's one of the classic moments in that movie series. I mean, it got a massive laugh. Every time I've seen Raiders, it gets a huge laugh. Every single time he just shoots the guy. And it's really funny. Like, it's very funny, but it was out of necessity. Because he couldn't, you know, he couldn't film for more than, like, 5 minutes because he had to run off to the bathroom. He was in terror. I mean, it was terrible. He was sick for days. Everybody on that, everybody on that set got sick. Everybody on that location got sick except Spielberg. Because he was not eating. This is actual fact. It's a true story. Spielberg went through a period of time where he was obsessed with SpaghettiOs, and that was pretty much all he'd eat. So people are making fun of him. He brought cans of SpaghettiOs with him and would eat that. He's the only one that didn't get sick. He's the only one that wasn't physically ill with some sort of horrific stomach illness because he was eating canned SpaghettiOs. It's a true story. But that's how that happened. Steve, thanks for the call. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Here's Jay on WGN. Hi, Jay.
Rick, hi. I love your show. I love WGN. I'd like to contribute two films to your talk right now.
Okay.
The first one is, these are two old school films. The first one was a 1968 film called Where Angels Go, Trouble Follows, with Rosalind Russell and Susan St. James. Tommy Boyce and Bobby Hart wrote the opening song for this film, and according to the book, the autobiography of Bobby Hart, Psychedelic Bubblegum, the production company asked Tommy Boyce and Bobby Hart if they could appear as a cameo in the opening scene of the film singing the song that they wrote. That's my first contribution. And the second one is much the same thing. It's the old school film Titanic, the 1953 version. Robert Wagner, a very young Robert Wagner, appeared in this film and was asked to sing a song in this film. He did, and it was used, and it can be found, Titanic 1953 song clip, and it's the song of Lord Jeffrey Amherst.
Okay. So those are two improvised songs that that were thrown in at the last minute. All right, Jay, thanks for the call. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Here's Banana Bread Steve. Hi, Steve.
Morning.
Hi, go ahead.
Enjoying your show again, as usual.
Thank you.
It's actually Banana Bread Steve from 5 o'clock the other last week.
I got you. Go ahead, Steve.
Well, the movie is Jaws, actually, when they're down in the belly of the ship. And it was real quiet, and they were discussing each other's tattoos.
Well, it's scars.
And,
they were scars,
Robert,
actually.
Robert Shaw, I guess Shaw was drunk on his ass.
Yes, he was.
Excuse me. And they all start comparing tattoos, and Dreyfus leans over, and what's that one on your arm? And he starts telling them about the ship and how they all got surrounded by the sharks. And,
right, that's the U.S. Indianapolis. It's one of the greatest monologues in film history. It is truly one of the greatest monologues in film history. Robert Shaw is unbelievable. Now, the idea of who wrote that has been legendary and in question since the movie came out in 1975. Some people say John Milius wrote it. Some people say Carl Gottlieb, who wrote the screenplay, wrote it. Some people say Shaw wrote it himself. So a lot of people think it's a combination of all of that stuff, because Milius, I know, did an uncredited screenwriting on it, and that sounds, you know, when you hear that monologue, that sounds like a John Milius monologue. But the thing is that if you watch this, if you watch Jaws and you watch Robert Shaw in that scene, deliver that monologue, the Indianapolis monologue, he was bombed, as you said, Steve. He was completely loaded. And that take that they use in the movie, because, you know, Spielberg knew that he was drunk, because he was drunk, Robert Shaw was a big, big, big time drinker. And so he would show up on set drunk a lot. And so he was completely annihilated when they had to film this monologue, the Indianapolis monologue scene. And so he set up four cameras. Spielberg set up four cameras because he was like, okay, we're only going to get one take at this because he's completely annihilated. And the take that you see in the movie is the one take that they did, that Spielberg shot, and Shaw is bombed. Like, he's, like, unbelievably bombed. And when he finishes the monologue, after he finished the monologue, and Spielberg called cut, Shaw just collapsed on the table and passed out. Like, right after the monologue, he passed out. And then what ended up in the movie is Shaw completely annihilated on booze. delivering one of the greatest monologues in movie history. But again, you know, how much of that was improvised by Shaw, how much of it was written by John Milius or Carl Gottlieb, that's up to, that's been an argument for all these years. So, all right, Banana Bread Steve, thank you for the call. We got to take a break. We got the news coming up and then more movie moments that were unplanned. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. And, it's Monday morning. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke. Nice choice there, Ben. I love me some Echo and the Bunnymen.
Thank you.
That's a great song.
I agree.
All right. We are talking about movie scenes. Sometimes, you know, you get lucky when you're making a movie. And something that's unplanned happens, and it turns out to not only be a part of the movie, but becomes iconic. And we've been talking about some of these movie scenes that just, they weren't planned. It wasn't supposed to happen, and they've turned out to be huge. And there's a lot of them, too. And if you want to jump in here with your thoughts, we've had some people call in with some stuff that I never knew, and we want to hear more from you guys at 312-981-7200 for talk and text. 312-981-7200. The next one here is from the movie Annie Hall, the classic Woody Allen movie. Sometimes the funniest scenes in a movie are among the funniest of all time. They weren't written that way. Pressured to partake by his girlfriend Annie Hall, played by Diane Keaton, the neurotic Alvy, Woody Allen picks up a box of cocaine to inspect, and then he sneezes, turning the white powder into a ginormous cloud. No one knows exactly what happened, except the fact that the sneeze was sincere, caused by a reaction to the fake powder. And that was a real sneeze, and it wasn't supposed to happen. And it actually turns out to be a really, really funny moment in the movie. But yeah, that was not supposed to happen. That was a real sneeze. So if you go back and watch Annie Hall, the reaction to the other three, because there's three other people in the scene besides Woody Allen, there's Diane Keaton and another couple. And the reaction on their faces when he sneezes is pretty funny, because it wasn't supposed to happen. So you just look at their reactions. That's part of the fun too, of knowing that these things weren't supposed to happen, is when you go back and watch them again, keeping an eye on the other people in the scene or what's happening, people reacting to it. Here's another classic one, Midnight Cowboy. An accidental movie scenes go. This one is the stuff of legend. Lacking enough money to shut down the street, the crew of Midnight Cowboy shot around New York City traffic, resulting in one particularly close call as the two hustlers played by John Voight and Dustin Hoffman crossed the street, deep in conversation about the types of women who pay for sex. A taxi zoomed into the crosswalk to beat the light, slamming his hand on the cab's hood, his cigarette falling out of his mouth. Hoffman, as the combustive con man Ratso Rizzo, shouted, "Hey, I'm walking here." And it's a line that's been uttered by millions of New Yorkers since then. Again, improvised, because the cab actually, for real, jumped up and almost hit Dustin Hoffman. And that whole "Hey, I'm walking here," which is again gone down in history as one of the most sort of famous lines of all time, improvised.
When I was in New York, I just kept waiting and wanting somebody yell that while I was walking down the street.
It's they yell a lot of stuff in New York.
That they do.
Let's see, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. This is one of my favorite stories. Gene Wilder, man. Gene Wilder accepted the part of Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory on one condition, that he got to determine his on-screen entrance. And what an entrance it was. Leaving his candy factory, he limped, leaning heavily on a cane and furrowing his face in concentration toward an eager group of kids and caregivers. The crowd went silent in sympathy. And then, as the cane got stuck, Wilder fell to the ground, only to execute an astonishing somersault. Surprised and cheers ensued. Wilder explained that his choice in the iconic movie scene was that, from that time on, no one would know if I was lying or telling the truth. So that whole big entrance where he does that flip at the beginning, and he didn't tell anybody he was going to do it either. And so then from that point on, you're like, oh, maybe I won't trust this guy. Gene Wilder was just the best, man. He was brilliant. Here's another one. The Godfather. Paramount head Robert Evans quipped, "The war over casting the family Corleone was one of the most volatile than a war that the Corleone family fought on screen. The studio forced Marlon Brando to work for free due to his difficult reputation. The Godfather's opening scene, in which Brando strokes a cat and discourses on friendship, cemented the role as his. But that gray and white tabby, though, belonged to nobody. Director Francis Ford Coppola found the feline roaming around the set and gave it to Brando to see what would happen. The ploy worked so well that the crew, to worry that subtitles might have to be inserted over the purring. Instead, it became one of the cinema's most memorable and moving movie opening scenes." Yeah, that cat. Give something to Brando, and he'll just run with it. So, but that cat was became iconic. So, Ike from Country Club Hills sends in a text that says, the first Terminator movie, Schwarzenegger said in the script that he was supposed to say, "I'll be back." But he said to Cameron that he thought it would be more badass to just say, I'll be back. And it paid off because of the sequels. Yeah, he was supposed to say something else. 301 area code says, in Jaws, Roy Scheider ad-libbed the line, "You're going to need a bigger boat." Again, one of the most maybe the biggest line, the most quoted line in Jaws. 224 area code says, the movie Pretty Woman, with the scene with Gere and Roberts right before going to the opera, Gere snaps the diamond necklace box shut when showing it to Roberts, and she was startled to laughter. That was not that. That actually was genuine, because she didn't know he was going to do it. And it was just Richard Gere playing a joke, but it turned out so natural that her reaction turned out so natural that Gary Marshall left it in, and it turned out to be iconic. Another one from Ike says, the bombing scene in The Dark Knight when one of the explosives don't go off with the Joker's reaction was not scripted. Technical difficulties occurred with the explosives, but Heath Ledger stayed in character until the final bomb exploded. That's actually one of my favorite moments in that movie. That's when he's walking out of the, he's dressed up as a nurse, and he's walking out of the hospital, and the bomb didn't go off as was supposed to. And Ledger's fantastic, you know. I mean, I'm the only person on the planet that doesn't like the Christopher Nolan Batman movies. Like, I do not like The Dark Knight.
I like the first two.
But I don't like Batman Begins. No one really likes the third one that much.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Yeah, which is unfortunate because, you know, I have a tendency to like anything with Tom Hardy in it, because he's like one of my heroes.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm the only person on the planet. I just did not like The Dark Knight at all. But there's no denying Heath Ledger in that movie, because that's a fantastic performance. And that's my favorite moment in the entire movie. That really, truly is my favorite moment in the entire movie. Because there's like, one of the things that I know that he wanted to make that Nolan was making a very serious, you know, dark comic book movie.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no joy in those movies. None. You know what I mean? And and The Dark Knight is just like, and the only moment of joy in that movie, any joy in that movie is provided by Heath Ledger. But that's the best moment in the entire movie. That's like that one moment where it's like, oh, somebody's having a good time making this movie. At least one guy is. So, all right. Stuff that was improvised. Stuff that was just like a mistake. A happy accident that ended up becoming iconic movie gold. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We want to hear from you if you've got any, and I've got a bunch more here talking about moments in movies that were unplanned that turned out to be classic. 312-981-7200. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studio here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5 and the great Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. on Monday morning. It is Monday. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. We got that coming up as well. Right now, though, we're having some fun here talking about some iconic movie scenes that basically happened by mistake. They were unplanned. And either by mistake or something went wrong or somebody improvised something. Weren't originally planned to do it to be that way, but then they turned out to be iconic and classic. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. 312-981-7200. Here is Mike in Elgin on WGN. Hi, Mike.
Hi. How you doing?
Good. What's up?
Yeah, there's a scene in White Christmas where Danny Kaye and Bing Crosby are you know, trying to help the two girl singers, and they dress in drag and start lip-syncing a song.
Right.
And they got this big fan or whatever, and they're dancing with it, and then Bing, or Danny Kaye all of a sudden starts smacking Bing with it as they're dancing, and they're supposed to be lip-syncing, and Bing just starts laughing, and Danny Kaye keeps smacking them, and Bing's laughing, and he's supposed to be lip-syncing the song, you know, and it's just the funniest scene.
Yeah. Yeah, so they
would.
Yeah, I remember that. I remember that. Danny Kaye doing that to Bing and breaking up the scene. So, yeah.
Yeah. Right.
All right, Mike, thanks.
Great. Yep.
Take care.
You're welcome.
Bye.
All right.
So here's another one from Jaws here that they've got listed here. So many things went wrong during the filming of Jaws that some crew members referred to the movie as flaws. Despite the accidents and the mishaps, Steven Spielberg's movie became the first summer blockbuster the first true summer blockbuster. And in both the novel and the original screenplay, Matt Hooper, played by Richard Dreyfuss, is killed in his shark cage. But in the movie, to make up for the malfunctioning mechanical sharks used in the main shoot, a second crew filmed real sharks in Australia, including one attacking an empty cage. Spielberg liked the footage so much, he incorporated it into the movie's scenes, thereby saving Hooper's life. So Hooper dies in the original cut of the movie, the original screenplay, and in the book he dies. And I remember the first time I saw Jaws. Well, you know, the many times I saw Jaws in the theater, but I remember specifically the first time seeing Jaws, and everybody just assumed that. That Hooper was dead. Everybody just thought Richard Dreyfuss was dead. And then when he pops up at the end of the movie, after Roy Scheider, you know, blows up the shark and everything, when Dreyfuss pops up at the end of that movie, the entire audience, every time, you know, like three or four times I saw it in the theater, would just bust out in applause. They would just cheer because they were so happy that Hooper didn't die, because Hooper was one of the favorite characters in that movie. So many people loved him in that movie. But yeah, so he was originally supposed to die, but because of the mistakes. And I'll tell you something else, that, you know, the original shoot of Jaws, when they were shooting that movie, as they alluded to in that little piece that I just read, they had a terrible time during the making of that movie. There was bad weather. There was continuity issues with being out on the water, and not to mention the nightmare of the mechanical shark that just didn't work. So originally Spielberg was going to show the shark a lot more, like there were going to be a lot more scenes showing the shark. But because the mechanical shark didn't work, he had to cut back on those shots of the shark. And that's one of the reasons why Jaws works so well, because, you know, for the first part of the movie, you don't even get to see the shark, but it's still scary as hell and much more mysterious, and it works a lot better. So out of necessity, you know, because these mechanical sharks didn't work at all, and there was all kinds of issues, he had to cut back on how many shark scenes that were going to be in the movie. And then, as a result, again, much more effective. Yeah. Jaws had a lot of mistakes on set. So, let's see. Here's John on WGN. Hi, John.
Hi, Nick. Hi. I was reading in Leonard Nimoy's book in Star Trek, The Voyage Home. Well, you remember whether that was a movie about they're trying to find a whale to answer a signal?
Yeah, they go back to San Francisco to get these to save these whales, right?
Okay, so they send the search party to San Francisco. So they filmed a scene where they were walking in downtown San Francisco, and they kind of looked kind of bewildered. And Walter Koenig and Denise Nichols, who were Chekhov and Aurora, right, around the street. people walk along the street near the scouting party, and some of those people weren't invited to be in the shoot. But so anyway, Denise Nichols and Walter Chekhov say to a lady on the street, "Do you know where the nuclear wessels are?" And the lady turns to him and says to him, "Well, I think they're in Alameda." And it was completely improvised. You know, they didn't know who she was, but they decided Nimoy thought it was such a great piece of originality that they included it in the movie, but they had to get the lady to sign a release.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Can I mention a second film? Have you ever seen Lovers and Other Strangers?
Years ago. I haven't seen it in a very, very long time.
I think that had something in a wedding scene that wasn't planned for.
Okay. All right. But, okay, John, thanks.
All right.
Take care. All right. Let's see. You got any more here? 312-981-7200. Here's Mel on WGN. Hi, Mel.
Great, great program as always. Thanks for your time, Nick.
What's up?
I'll do this real quick. Movie Stripes, and I'll cut right to the chase. Movie Stripes, and Bill Murray is crossing the street with the pizza, and then the pizza drops out of the box. He picks it back up and puts it back in the box, and he's going up the stairs to the apartment, and I heard it was not Daryl Hannah, but there's a young lady who's working out, hitting a punching bag or whatever. He gets up to the apartment. You don't see him walk in, but he gets too close, and she hits him.
You're confusing two movies, Mel.
Oh, okay, go ahead.
Yeah, because it was Daryl Hannah. You're talking about the Pope of Greenwich Village.
Okay.
That's the one where, and she punches Mickey Rourke. And she actually punched, she actually belted him. But that you were confusing the two movies because, the pizza, dropping the pizza is definitely Stripes. But, when he goes up to his apartment in Stripes, his girlfriend, is getting dressed, and he's got her dry cleaning, and he dropped it all over the place, and he brought, and so that's when she leaves him, and that's when, of course, he says, "You can't leave, all the plants are going to die," which is one of my favorite lines in Stripes. But you got a little confused. It's Daryl Hannah was working out, was punching a box, the heavy bag, and she did punch Mickey Rourke, like she belted him, and you could see it in the movie too. As soon as she punches him, he's like, "What the?" But yeah, you got both of them are correct, Mel, but you got them a little bit confused. You got your movies confused, but it's Pope of Greenwich Village is the one that you were thinking of. All right, let's see. Here's from Animal House. Although Animal House was his first movie, John Belushi was already a star improviser, having honed his skills through several seasons on Saturday Night Live. Writers Chris Merler, Harold Ramis, and Douglas Kenny based the script on their own fraternity experiences, yet allowed Belushi a lot of autonomy to do what he did best when the cameras rolled. So much of that stuff that Belushi does in that movie, like that whole thing where he's in the cafeteria going down the line and shoving food into his face and all that stuff was just him. There was just like Landis put the camera on and said, "Go ahead." And that led to the famed cafeteria scene. Upon being called a pig, he smashes his cheeks together, spewing potatoes onto a bunch of clean-cut pledges, and he says, "I'm a zit." Get it? That was improvised too. But all of that stuff in the cafeteria, that was all just Belushi, and it's just brilliant. It's just brilliant. Okay, all right, everybody, hang on. We'll get back to the phone calls here at 312-981-7200. We're talking about classic movie scenes that were not planned. 312-981-7200. We'll talk more about that after the news, which is next. All right, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5. Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And much more. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. We've been talking about famous movie scenes that actually weren't planned. they happened by mistake, or somebody improvised, or they had to do something to make up for something that went wrong. And these mistakes or these unplanned events have now gone down as sort of classic iconic moments in movie history. And if you guys have any, 312-981-7200, here's the next one, is Goodfellas. A lot of Goodfellas was, you know, a lot of Scorsese movies, he allows a lot of improvisation, especially when he's working with guys like De Niro. So in Goodfellas, there's the classic, you know, one of the, well, it's one classic scene, like every scene in Goodfellas is classic. But one of the classic moments in the movie is the where Pesci and Liotta are sitting around with all the guys in the club. And Ray Liotta says that Tommy is funny. And then the whole funny how, what am I, a clown? I amuse you? That was all, they worked that out between Scorsese, Liotta, and Pesci. They worked that out. The beats of it was improvised. It was all, like Pesci said, he based it on when he was working as a waiter when he was a young guy. He was working as a waiter, and he... it was a place where a lot of mob guys would hang out that he was working. And I guess he made a joke or something to a connected guy, and this guy was not happy about it. This gangster guy was not happy about it. So it was based in an actual thing that happened in Pesci's real life, you know, waiting on these mobsters.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So, but the thing is, here's another thing. And now that I'm bringing this up, this is another excuse to watch Goodfellas again. Like there's an excuse to watch Goodfellas again. Everybody else in that scene, when the whole, you talk, you know, you think, how am I funny? Funny how? Everybody except for Pesci and Liotta didn't know that was coming.
Oh, that's cool.
So Scorsese have all these other actors who are just kind of sitting around, and suddenly they start freaking out because this isn't supposed to be happening right now. So, like, here's Pesci's going nuts, you know, like, and so that sense of relief when Pesci finally lets him off the hook and says, I got you, that whole thing. You could see these actors just go, like they've been holding their breath, like while this exchange between Liotta and Pesci is just like getting more tense and more tense, and Pesci's just not letting up. You could see those actors. It's another fun reason to go back and watch that, because those actors had no idea. So Scorsese and Pesci and Liotta planned that so that they were going to do that on set in the moment and to get the real reaction from those guys.
Have you seen the Family Guy episode where they poke fun at that scene?
I probably, yeah.
When he starts asking, you know, what kind of funny? And he starts listing on, you know, Rita Rudnoff funny? He's like, oh, well, yes. He's like, oh, well, why, thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I didn't. I remember that. So, all right, here's Harold on WGN. Go ahead, Harold.
Yeah. Bryce Schrader in the movie Seven Ups, kind of a semi-sequel to The French Connection. They wanted to outdo the car chase scene, so they have this massive car chase scene, and the car runs into the back of the semi. It's, I don't know, they have said it was true, that exactly what happened is they didn't know the truck was there. Anyways, one way or the other, it's Hollywood folklore, one way or the other.
So
that truck was not supposed to be there,
and so they slammed into it, and
then they just basically shot more scenes to make it appear, you know.
Right.
And also the French Connection, they shot a lot of that stuff. They didn't, again, just like you were saying earlier, they didn't get permits, and cars came out of driveways, and you know, and got tapped by some of the cars in the chase scenes.
Yeah, no, that's true. They shot that on the fly. The French Connection. I've had William Friedkin on the show a couple of times, and first of all, fantastic guest, William Friedkin, just brilliant. It's crazy because like I'm sort of Harold, thanks for the call. I'm sort of obsessed, like unhealthily, with The Exorcist. It's like one of my favorite movies like ever, and just the way that movie was shot, the way it was made, the reaction that people had to it. Because I was a kid, I saw it when I was eight. My dad took me to see The Exorcist when I was eight. Unbeknownst to my mom, because it was funny. I don't, you know, this is a true story, and I've mentioned it on the air before. My dad would take me to see anything. You know what I mean? I saw R-rated movies when I was way too young. I saw a lot of stuff that, you know, young kids shouldn't probably see, like R-rated violence, nudity, you know, all that stuff at a very, very young age. So I was desensitized at a pretty young age. So my parents went to go see The Exorcist when it came out. You have to understand, when The Exorcist came out, it was a phenomenon. I mean, it was a cultural phenomenon. People were waiting 2 hours in line to see this movie, and it came out in the winter. And so it came out at the end of 1973, it came out. So not only were people waiting in line, not only was it 2 hour waits, but people were passing out in the theater. People were having violent, sick reactions to the movie. They had medical staff. They had a medical staff at a bunch of theaters in order to help people. They had like nurses and smelling salts available because people were just passing out and having horrible reactions to the movie. And there had been nothing like it, you know, nothing. So all of that stuff combined with, you know, just the movie itself, and then just how legendary it was when it came out and the kind of effect that it had on an audience and how much money it made. And but then the behind the scenes stuff, the shooting of that movie. I mean, they could make a movie out of the shooting of the movie. And I've had Friedkin on the show, and I tend to monopolize the conversation with The Exorcist questions. You know, the guy's directed some amazing movies, some great, great, great movies. But I tend to stick right with a whole bunch of Exorcist questions. And there was stuff that there were mistakes that happened in the making of The Exorcist that stayed in the movie. I mean, it's really surprising how many mistakes or how many accidents happen during the course of making a movie that end up in the movie and then become, you know, famous for it. I mean, The Exorcist is another one. It's another one that had all kinds of crazy stuff happen on the set that they had to use. How about this one? Ghostbusters. Dan Aykroyd originally imagined a movie about ghost-busting time travelers that would star his SNL colleagues John Belushi and Eddie Murphy. However, Ghostbusters turned out much differently. The accidental death of Belushi led to Bill Murray being cast as the sardonic Peter Venkman, which led to a slew of improvised lines during Ghostbusters. During the shoot of the library scene, a crew member knocked over a bookcase by accident, causing Murray to deadpan, "This happened to you before?" Aykroyd as Ray slowly shook his head. "Oh, first time." Aykroyd slowly nodded, and director Ivan Reitman enjoyed the exchange so much that he kept it in the movie. So, but yeah, they improvise a lot. There's a lot of stuff that's improvised in any movie. When you have Bill Murray in a movie, there's going to be improvising. There's just no question about it. So that just goes with the territory. Let's see. Here is Donald on WGN. Hi, Donald.
Hi. I remember the scene from Roman Holiday where Gregory Peck is showing the princess around town with Audrey Hepburn.
Uh-huh.
And there's this one famous wall figure. It's a sculpture and with an open mouth. And you're not supposed to put your hand in there, according to legend, you know. And he does, and he screams as if the mouth is biting him, and she screams, and that was just improvised.
And it just ended up in the movie then.
Yeah, and one other thing I wanted to say, did you know that there's like a cult on eBay about the Zuzu, the demon Babylonian god of the wind that's the exorcist demon, right?
Right.
And you can actually go on eBay to like go under Pazuzu and buy Pazuzu items.
Yeah, that's I know. It's based on reality as well. All right, Donald. Yeah. Thanks, buddy.
Mm-hmm.
All right, all right. We'll take a break here. We've got some weather here, and then after the weather, we'll jump back into this. And if you want to text us or call us with your unplanned movie moments that have gone down as classics now, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Okay, here's your forecast from the WGN Chicago Weather Center for today. A few scattered clouds, but considerable sunshine at fair new afternoon highs between 40 and 45. Tomorrow, sunny turns to cloudiness with a high the mid to upper 40s. Wednesday, a chance of precipitation early on and then becoming partly sunny with a high in the low 50s. For Thursday, mostly sunny skies, highs between 50 and 55, but cooler near the lake. And then Friday, mostly sunny skies, mild afternoon highs between 50 and 55. Currently 30 degrees at O'Hare. It's 32 at Midway, 33 at the lakefront. All right, let's take a little break here. And when we come back, more movie moments that became classic despite the fact that they weren't planned. And if you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200. Okay, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio. We're here till 5 a.m. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in a little bit to tell a joke on a Monday morning joke. And our phone number is 312-981-7200. Talk and text lines are open if you want to jump in. We've been talking about classic movie scenes that were unplanned, that were done by mistake, or something happened and wasn't supposed to happen that way, and they turn out to be classic scenes. 312-981-7200 for talk and text if you want to jump in. Next is The Goonies. In an interview commemorating the 30th anniversary of The Goonies, director Richard Donner said that he loved working with the film's child actors because of their pure, wonderful, unprogrammed minds. As challenging as it was to get the kids to pay attention to their marks, they also brought incredible energy and incredible ideas, including the truffle shuffle. In an early scene, the gang forced Chunk, played by Jeff Cohen, to dance before they let him into the house. He pulled up his shirt, grimaced, and shook his belly, an entirely spur-of-the-moment series of movements that perfectly captured kids being kids. And that, again, has gone down as, some people's favorites, one of their favorite scenes in the entire movie. And that was improvised. So, 312-981-7200 is the phone number here. Here's Mary on WGN. Hi, Mary.
Hi.
Hi.
From what I understand, the scene in when Harry met Sally, the restaurant scene,
yeah,
where she fakes it,
yep,
that was unplanned.
Okay. They filmed that in Katz's deli in New York, and I know that the, you know, when she finishes that when Meg Ryan finishes the fake orgasm moment. The line after that, I'll have what she's having. They did come up with at the spur of the moment. The scene itself was actually written the way it was, but they did come up with that at the spur of the moment. And Rob Reiner liked the line so much, he gave it to his mother. That's Rob Reiner's mom who says, I'll have what she's having. So that's kind of a classic moment. They came up with it on the spur of the moment. You're right, Mary. And then but the best detail is that Rob Reiner gave that line to his mom. Oh, man. All right, how about The Breakfast Club? The Breakfast Club was shot in sequence, so the emerging bond we can see on screen is to some extent the result of the developing bonds between the actors off screen. Writer-director John Hughes urged the actors to augment the lines in the script. This went double duty for the library scene, when each character explains how he or she landed in detention that day. Another notable invention. John Bender, played by Judd Nelson, told himself a joke about a naked blonde and a poodle and a salami as he crawled through the ducts, only to crash through the ceiling before he reaches the punchline. And Nelson completely invented the setup. It's not a real joke. Judd Nelson came up with it. Because you know what? People have come up over all these years. This movie's been out for such a long time, and it's become such a classic. Judd Nelson has said that he can't tell you the number of times people have come up to him and said, hey, what's the punchline to that joke? And then how many people are disappointed when he says, it's not a joke, I just kind of made that up. And they were like, what? So all these years, people are wondering what the punchline is to that joke. And it was just a bunch of nonsense that that he made up. all right. Thanks, Mary. 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you would like to join us. So Full Metal Jacket. Now, this was all, you know, in the basic training sequences at the beginning of that movie, Kubrick just let Arlie Ermey go. I mean, the guy was a real drill sergeant, and a lot of that dialogue was stuff that he said in reality. Arlie Ermey was nominated for a Golden Globe for his portrayal of a drill instructor in Full Metal Jacket. After Ermey retired from the Marine Corps, he sought to draw on his military experience as a technical director on movies. He convinced Stanley Kubrick to hire him by submitting a homemade audition in which he shouted insults as oranges and tennis balls came flying at his head. Ermey improvised much of the dialogue, doing a nearly six-minute movie scene in which he spews verbal venom at Marine recruits. Kubrick estimated that Ermy generated some 150 pages of insults in preparation. Among them, what is your major malfunction? 150? What? Oh, man. Okay. 40-year-old virgin. Like a lot of Judd Apatow movies, they do a bunch of different takes where they improvise stuff. And that's also true of Adam McKay, especially on the Anchorman movies. They just have the camera go, and you know McKay will throw a different line at him to try out and see what works. And my favorite Adam McKay movie, and my favorite Will Ferrell movie of all time is The Other Guys with Will Ferrell and Mark Wahlberg. And if you look at the outtakes at the end of the movie, there's so much improvisation going on and so much screwing around. I mean, you know, working on those kind of movies must be a blast because, you know, just do a bunch of takes and try different things and improvise and try and be as funny as possible. And there's a lot of freedom in that, and that's pretty cool. But The Other Guys is one of those movies that there's a ton of improvisation in it, and it's hilarious. But the 40-year-old virgin, although acting means pretending, some actors choose to film movie scenes live in order to heighten the authenticity. So it was with Steve Carell who decided to get his chest waxed live on camera as part of the 40-year-old virgin. He had no idea what he was in for as he laid down on the table and they ripped off that first chunk of hair. A beat of silence followed by a tiny cry that rapidly escalated into a howl. Carell then let out a legit torrent of obscenities ranging from something else to Kelly Clarkson to X-rated insults involving a complicated interplay of anatomy and bodily functions. Yeah. The waxing scene was just, that was all improvised. That's whatever happened, whatever came out of Carell's mouth just came out of his mouth. And again, that's true of a lot of Apatow movies. The Judd Apatow, like Adam McKay and that group of guys, allows a lot of improv. And and I still have to count the Other Guys as my favorite Will Ferrell movie. Him and Mark Wahlberg. Mark Wahlberg is hilarious in that movie. Here's John on WGN. Hi, John.
Hey, John. I had a question. When you mentioned Bill Murray, I was thinking about the movie Lost in Translation. At the end of the movie, when him and Scarlett Johansson are standing in the street,
yeah,
he leans over and he whispers something to her.
Yep.
And somebody said something about, did he really say something? Was it part of the script, or was he leaving the audience hanging? Did you know the answer to that one?
The actual, nobody knows what he whispers. Nobody will tell. And nobody will say anything. And it was purposely left out so that the audience doesn't hear it. That was Sofia Coppola's choice. I don't know what he whispered to her. I don't know whether it was written in the script or whether it was improvised. All I know is that no one will tell what he says. We'll never know what Bill Murray says to Scarlett Johansson.
Until the sequel.
Yeah, well, there's not going to be a sequel. I mean, the movie's like 20 years old already. But
I'm just kidding.
Yeah. Okay, right. Thanks, John.
Very good, thanks.
Okay. Yeah, so no, I mean, he whispers something in her ear. I like that ambiguity. I like not knowing what he says to her, you know? It's a really intimate moment in that movie, and they had such a wonderful relationship. God, that's a good movie. That is such a good movie. Man. And I love the fact that you don't really know what he says to her. I think that makes it all the more sort of romantic and kind of beautiful that we're not allowed to know. Like, the audience is like, look, you've just spent, 2 hours with these people. Let them have a moment. Let them have this moment between the two of them. And I think it's a beautiful moment. I really do. And I know a lot of people are frustrated by it. Like, what did he say to her? I want to know what he said. And I'm like, hey, it's not our business, man. That's between them two. So, okay. All right, we got a break here for some news. And then when we come back, we'll talk more about movie scenes that became classic despite the fact that they weren't planned. And a little bit later on, my dad's going to call in and tell a joke. But let's jump into the newsroom in just a couple of seconds here. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everybody. Dick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. And that, of course, is Dick Dale, who passed away at the age of 81. A guitar legend who basically invented the surf guitar genre, of which you just heard. So it's 81 years old, and he's got one of the most iconic guitar sounds of all time. And he had a number. He's been sick for a while with a number of illnesses, but no cause was given. But he had fought. You know, he had kidney disease. He had diabetes. He had a bout with cancer at one time. He was sick for a while. Been struggling with his health for a long time, but he passed away at age 81. And Ben, when you were working in the bar biz, you actually got to meet him a couple of times.
Yeah, super nice guy, and always took time for his fans. He and his wife, they were just really nice, genuine people.
Well, you know, and he was a legend too. I mean, the guy was absolutely a legend, and it was and I really love the fact that like he did have that renaissance time in '94. When Pulp Fiction came out, like, you know, like a lot of people were like, oh, I don't Dick Dale. Yeah, I remember him. But then, like, when the soundtrack, when Pulp Fiction went through the roof, there was a whole resurgence in his career. Like, he was booking gigs and touring and stuff. So he got that second half of his, you know, later part of his career. But he's always been considered a legend. Anybody who's ever played guitar, or anybody who, you know, who is appreciative of guitar, this guy is legendary. And one of the most distinctive sounds in music history. And he was an icon. So, yeah. 81 years old, and rest in peace, Dick Dale. All right. We are getting back to movie scenes that actually were unplanned, some by mistake and some just happened, and they turned out to be classics. Here's one for Wayne's World. A description of the most famous scene in Wayne's World sounds like a setup for a joke. Five headbangers drive around in the 1976 AMC Pacer singing along to, well, producer Lorne Michaels wanted a Guns N' Roses song, but actor and screenwriter Mike Myers argued for Bohemian Rhapsody, and in fact, he threatened to leave the set unless he got his way. And then, you know, because it just seems like a weird choice, you know, for these guys to be jamming to Bohemian Rhapsody. In the resulting scene, the actors banged so hard that Myers said he and Dana Carvey injured their necks. It's a small price to pay for greatness. One of the most iconic movie scenes in recent comedy history helped return the song to popularity, and nowadays it's a staple in sports arenas and stations alike. So, The Dark Knight, this is the one we were talking about earlier when the explosion didn't happen, and it's Heath Ledger. Reservoir Dogs, speaking of Quentin Tarantino, when it comes to knives and ears, you'd think filmmakers and actors alike would want the action as carefully composed as possible. Not so in Reservoir Dogs, the infamous torture scene. The script offered the briefest of guidance. Mr. Blonde maniacally dances around. Director Quentin Tarantino believed actor Michael Madsen could concoct what the movie scene required on the spot. Madsen wasn't so sure, but he trusted the director's instinct. Rather than rehearse or even listen to Stuck in the Middle with You ahead of time, Madsen just started shuffling, gyrating, and lip-syncing as soon as Tarantino called action, and after three takes, Tarantino yelled cut. So that whole dance that Michael Madsen does, that was improvised. And, of course, again, classic. So, let's see. Here's Carl on WGN. Hi, Carl.
Hey, Nick. Hey. Tom Cruise, Color Money. The stairwell scene, that happened, I think, was that over on Milwaukee Avenue? By the firehouse?
Yeah.
And was the handrail not supposed to break? That happened when he hit his hands on it? I heard that in the past.
I don't remember. I don't know the story. I've seen the movie several times, but I don't know the story behind that.
Yeah, because I heard that when Slate got mad, put his hands on the handrail, slammed it down, it actually fell off. That's why he looked a little shocked at first.
Oh, okay. We'll have to go back and watch that one again. All right. Carl, thanks for the call. We got some texts here. 301 area code. The reactions of the actors in the chest-bursting scene in Alien is genuine because they did not know what was going to happen. That's absolutely true. If you watch that scene, look at Veronica Cartwright. She is terrified when that thing busts out of John Hurt's chest because they really didn't know. Ridley Scott didn't tell him. And it particularly, I mean, I'm telling you, Veronica Cartwright is like loses her mind during that. Let's see. Ilsa Fisher almost drowned in her fish tank escape scene in Now You See Me, Now You See Me to do safety equipment failure, and they never removed her, pointing to the director and trying to alert to the situation, so she almost drowned. Boy, that would have been not worth it for that movie. Jeez. 708 area code says, in Hatari, all the cast is milking goats for the baby elephants. The character Pockets is having trouble and asks John Wayne for help, in which John Wayne tells him that's the wrong kind of goat, implying that it was male. One of my favorite Wayne lines is rumored to have been improvised. 708 area code, Sleepless in Seattle, Tom Hanks and his friend at the kitchen table telling war stories was improvised. 312, this is Linda on the north side of Chicago. A scene in Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, Glenn Strange, who played the monster, punched through a breakaway door which Lou Costello was holding shut. And it's been said that Lou was injured by Strange during that scene. Well, he's a big dude. Glenn Strange was a big dude. Yeah?
I was just going to say, by the way, I love that Sleepless in Seattle scene.
Do you?
Yeah, I mean, when Tom Hanks gets all misty-eyed, you know, like it's a chick flick, but he's talking about the Dirty Dozen.
Yeah. I mean, I've only seen the movie once
when it
came out.
Best scene of the whole movie.
815 area code says, I believe the police lineup scene in the movie Usual Suspects was improvised. You can see that the actors are laughing while they're trying to recite the line. That is absolutely true. That is absolutely true. And nobody, I mean, again, people are busting out laughing. You can't understand a word that Benicio del Toro says in that entire movie. He's brilliant in it. He's my favorite. I'm not a big fan of that movie, but I think he's great in it. I mean, he's really, really great in it. And just that voice and the way he talks and everything. And yeah, that scene where they're trying to say that line of dialogue that I can't say on the air while they're in the lineup, that was in fact improvised. You can tell. I mean, these guys were like, they were losing it. Django Unchained. To emphasize a point about his human property in a scene from Django Unchained, slave owner Calvin J. Candy, played by Leonardo DiCaprio, smeared his bloody hand across the face of Broomhilda, played by Kerry Washington, his clearly horrified slave. The horror was authentic, as DiCaprio had accidentally cut his hand while smashing a glass. It was a cut so deep that it later required many stitches. But he stayed in character, however, gesturing with his profuse bleeding hand, and continued his racist rant, much to the shock and revulsion of his dinner guests, among them Django, played by Jamie Foxx, and Dr. King Schultz, played by Christoph Waltz. After the take, DiCaprio's fellow actors gave him a standing ovation. I remember the first time when I first saw Django, I was like, man, that looks real. You know, like when he's bleeding, because it was real. But he really did cut his hand, and he's bleeding all over the place. And I was like, wow, that looks really authentic. And then I found out, obviously, you know, during the publicity circuit for the movie, they told this, you know, everybody told the story about how he cut his hand wide open. And poor Kerry Washington. But that's how committed DiCaprio is, man. And Leonardo DiCaprio is a great actor. He's a great actor. I love watching that guy, and he's fantastic in Django. I mean, he's amazing in that movie. I remember seeing it, going, man, that looks real. That looks so real because it was. All right, how about this? Before we break here, Fight Club. While much of Fight Club is hitting someone is about hitting someone as hard as you can, that didn't necessarily mean the actors looked forward to being pummeled. To prepare for the movie's violence, both Edward Norton and Brad Pitt took grappling, boxing, and taekwondo lessons, as well as studied mixed martial arts fights. Nevertheless, Pitt, as Tyler Durden, wasn't exactly ready to get cuffed in the ear. The scene was scripted for Norton's narrator to punch Durden's shoulder. At the last second, David Fincher asked, advised Norton to aim for Pitt's ear. Pitt's response, "You hit me in the ear," is absolutely genuine, because the actor was angry and it couldn't believe what had just happened. So he was supposed to hit him in the shoulder, and then Fincher said, clock him on the ear. Oh, I love that movie. I love that movie. But it's so weird because I always talk about this. I had read the book before I saw the movie. And so I knew that he was Tyler Durden already. And so it's weird for me to, like, I always ask people, what's that like when you don't know? Because I read the book. Because that's like a huge twist, you know, like one of those big surprise, like the narrator turns out to be Tyler Durden. He's one and the same. And so I always ask people, what was that like to experience that, you know, to actually, you didn't read the book before you saw the movie?
No.
So you were like, oh my God, he's Tyler Durden?
Yeah.
Yeah. And there, it's funny because there are hints throughout the entire movie.
Yeah. That when are you go back and watch it a second time, yeah. I was like, oh man, this is awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there are moments where he just pops up subliminally. Like you'll see Tyler Durden just like pop up in the foreground of a scene, stuff like that. But yeah, I knew already. I was so mad. I was like, oh man, this is not as fun. The movie's great though. And they changed the ending. They changed the ending of the movie, of the book.
Now I have to go read the book now.
Now it goes on longer. It goes on longer, and it's got a very strange. The book's got a very strange ending. The ending of the movie is one of my favorite final shots in motion picture history.
Oh yeah,
is the two of them?
Mm-hmm.
You know, his face blown off. They're holding hands. To me, it's one of the most romantic moments in movie history. I think it's one of the most beautiful romantic moments in movie history. As the entire financial world is crumbling, literally mm-hmm. crumbling in front of them. The Pixies are playing, and then a big penis pops up on the screen. And I was just like, this is the greatest ending I've ever seen in my life. The key to it is the Pixies, which is the perfect song.
Agreed.
So, all right, we got a break here. We got weather, and then we'll take a break, and my dad will be here to tell a joke, and that's coming up right after this. Today, a few scattered clouds, considerable sunshine in the afternoon, highs around 40 to 45. Tomorrow, sunny, turning to clouds, a high near the upper 40s. For Wednesday, a chance of precipitation early, partly sunny in the afternoon, highs in the lower 50s. For Thursday, mostly sunny skies, highs between 50 and 55, cooler at the lake. And then for Friday, mostly sunny skies and mild afternoon highs between 50 and 55. It's currently 30 degrees at O'Hare, it's 32 at Midway, and 33 at the lakefront. All right, let's take a quick break, and then my dad tells a joke right after this, and then we wrap up the show with all the more movie scenes that weren't planned.
Ooh, it's the best part of the week, baby! It's time to hear something funny. Here we go with your music intro.
It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. Nick's dad tells a joke.
Hey, what'd I say?
It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. Nick's dad tells a joke.
Oh, yes! Here we go.
All right. And welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago, and we are here until 5 a.m. It's Monday morning, and you know what that means. At this time, every Monday morning, my dad calls in and tells a joke. And so let's get him in here and say hello to my dad. Hey, Dad.
Hey, Nick.
How you doing?
Good. How are you?
All right. How's Ma?
Good.
Good. Okay, you got a joke.
Got a joke.
All right.
You know, I spent a fortune on deodorant before I realized people didn't like me anyway.
All right.
Okay, Nick.
That's a good one, Dad. Take care, buddy.
Thank you.
All right.
Okay, bye.
There you go. It wasn't the deodorant. They just didn't like him. All right.
That was jokey, jokey, jokey time. It was a jokey, jokey, jokey time. Nick's dad told a joke.
He'll do it again next week as well. All right. So we've been talking about movie scenes that were either improvised or they were done by mistake or they happened on accident and they weren't planned. And then they turn out to be pretty classic scenes. Now, this one is legendary, for me at least, because this is from This is from one of my all-time favorite movies ever made. It's from The Warriors, which is one of my favorite movies of all time, one of the greatest action movies ever made. And this is fantastic because it's one of the most iconic moments in the movie, one of the most memorable moments of the movie, and it's from The Warriors. But it was an ad-lib scene by actor David Patrick Kelly making his film debut as Luther, the leader, the Weasley leader of the Rogues. So at the end of the movie, the script required Luther to goad what's left of the Warriors into a fight, but the words weren't gelling. So Kelly grabbed a few beer bottles, stuck them on his fingers, and clinked them together for an ominous rhythm for several scary seconds. And then, recalling something a childhood neighbor used to say, he drawled a new line, which is, "Warriors, come out to play." And that was improvised by David Patrick Kelly. And I love that story because it's one of the most... I mean, come on. Whenever you think of the movie The Warriors, you think, "Warriors, come out to play." I mean, just classic. Absolute classic. So... Empire Strikes Back. Oh, I think everybody knows this one, right? When someone says, "I love you," a common reply is, "I love you too." That's how Han Solo might have responded to Princess Leia's expression of her feelings as he prepared to be enclosed in carbonite. But during the filming of The Empire Strikes Back, nothing seemed quite right for the rakish Solo. Director Irvin Kershner began brainstorming alternatives with Harrison Ford. "Just do whatever comes to your mind," Kershner urged. The result is a cinematic history widely considered to be one of the most iconic lines in the Star Wars franchise. Carrie Fisher gave her line, to which Ford responded, "I know." It's another like really classic moment that you have to love that response. Casino Royale. The first one with Daniel Craig, the first Bond movie with Daniel Craig. It's the movie scene that launched 1,000 memes and fantasies. A shirtless Daniel Craig emerged from the water, droplets glistening off of his perfect set of pecs and rolling into a skin-tight bathing suit with an echo of Ursula Andress on the beach in Dr. No. The whole hot scene was an accident. In his initial foray as 007, Craig was meant to swim to shore, but he hit a sandbar, which forced him upright. Craig said later that he first thought, "Uh-oh, I had no idea what I would be haunted by this for the rest of my life." For the rest of my life. So that was a mistake. He was supposed to swim in. Dumb and Dumber. In a 2013 AMA on Reddit, director and co-writer Peter Farrelly claimed that around 15% of Dumb and Dumber was completely improvised. I'm not surprised by that. Riding down the highway with his best friend Harry and hitchhiker henchman Lloyd Christmas posed a question no one would ever say yes to, and "Do you want to hear the most annoying sound in the world?" On screen, his high-pitched screech caused the actor playing Mike Starr, by the way, to scream for him to stop. Off screen, the movie scene launched a million imitators. And if you're just curious, there's a 2012 scientific study that found the world's most annoying sound is a knife on a bottle. If you go back and watch that scene, again, it's fun to go back and watch these, knowing that the stuff was not supposed to happen, that it was improvised. Keep your eye on Jeff Daniels when the scream starts. Daniels breaks, like he totally breaks, so when Jim Carrey starts that annoying scream, and Mike Starr, by the way, who is a tremendous actor from Chicago here, I know him, he's a good guy. He really is mad. Like, he's really like, "Shut up." So that whole sequence was okay. Oh, we got a traffic. Hold on a second. Mary, what's up?
Good morning. Sorry, but we have a problem with a outbound Eisenhower overturned car. They just reported all lanes are blocked right before First Avenue with this overturned car. So already traffic is backing up, and we'll keep you posted after the 5 o'clock news.
Okay. Thank you for busting in, Mary. Mary's in traffic. She's going to keep an eye on everything that's happening, and we'll get you up to date on what's going on. All right. Finally, Black Panther. Heavy is the head that wears the crown, or in this case, M'Baku in Black Panther. He wields a Wakandan scepter of power, unimpressed by the pleas of CIA operative Everett Ross, played by Martin Freeman, for help dealing with them and urging the defeat. There's a fierce, deep-throated sound that drowns out everything and stuns the supplicants into silence. Winston Duke, who played the character with a combination of dominance and drawlery, later admitted to devising the barking, "You cannot talk. One word, I will feed you to my children." So that was all improvised in Black Panther. So there you go. So those are just some of the improvised moments that happened that were by mistake. In Midnight Run, did Robert De Niro improvise the scene where he dropped the sunglasses after getting out of Mosley's squad car? Yeah, and he also improvised the moment where he stole the badge and turns around and flashes it. That was all De Niro, which is one of my favorite moments in that entire movie. And then in Tommy Boy, Chris Farley's character puts on the coat that's too small for him and starts singing Fat Guy in the Little Coat. Well, he used to do that all the time in SNL, in the office that he shared so he just threw it into the movie. But that was the thing. He would put on David Spade's coat, Fat Guy in a Little Coat. He would do that like every night when they were writing together on SNL. So, okay, let's break here. And then the news is coming up after this. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll be back tomorrow. And we got lots of fun topics. And we got Two for Tuesday coming up as well for your Tuesday.